Today's sponsor is Shudder, the premium streaming video service devoted to horror, thrillers, and suspense. Backed by AMC Networks, Shudder has a growing and dynamic selection of thrilling premieres, originals, and exclusives, including the pregnancy horror comedy Prevenge, the Ring vs. the Grudge franchise mashup Sadako vs. Kayoko, and We Are the Flesh. New and exclusive to Shudder is the stylish and atmospheric Sweet Sweet Lonely Girl. When Adele is sent to look after her Aunt Dora, she finds her aunt won't leave her room and barely speaks. So when Adele meets the seductive Beth, her lonely life improves for the first time. After Beth pushes her to shirk her duties, however, Adele faces a dangerous reckoning. Who is Beth and what does she want from Adele? From performances to visual style, A.D. Calvo's queer supernatural chiller evokes the eerie atmosphere of the 70s and 80s horror in much the same way Ty West did with The House of the Devil. Sweet Sweet Lonely Girl had its world premiere at Fantastic Fest last September. It is now streaming only on Shudder. Shudder is available on the web, iOS, Android, Chromecast, Apple TV, and Roku for $4.99 a month, or for $49.99 with an annual membership. But Shockwave's listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Again, that is promo code SHOCK. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of horror available to stream anywhere. Welcome to episode 51.
That's right.
I am your co-host, Ryan Turek, and I'm joined by Mr. Rob Sipping the Cup Galuzzo.
Yep. Gotta have my coffee.
Mr. Elric Kane.
Could I be sipping LaCroix?
Sipping a LaCroix.
LaCroix.
And
I got a LaCroix.
How elegant we are now.
Rebecca McKendry.
Well, it's a longer drive.
It's all coffee and LaCroix.
We can't afford beer anymore, so we're down to like tonic water.
And we're all back from Texas Frightmare Weekend.
Yes.
This is true. Yeah. Let's report back from the convention.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
It was a lot of fun. It was great to meet so many people that actually listened to the show.
Yeah.
And we did a live one there as well, which went rather well.
It did go well.
Yeah,
that
was a lot of fun.
That episode did really, like,
it did very well.
Got a lot of good feedback on that, so I'm glad everybody enjoyed it.
It was a lot of fun. You know, I was telling everybody, and I relayed this to you guys as well, it was nice to be at a convention that wasn't on one of the coasts, East Coast and West Coast, because it didn't really have anything to do with the industry. It just had, you know, it just brought everybody together in their love of horror. And it was very reinvigorating to be able to walk up to a complete stranger and have them ask you, hey, so I heard you talk about this movie, or what did you see recently that you really liked, as opposed to, hey, man, how's Blumhouse doing?
Yeah.
you want to cover my new movie?
In which I can't talk about what I'm up to. But it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun. And I spent way too much.
Yeah.
Way too much.
They're enablers there. This is your first time at this convention.
Yeah.
How did it compare to other ones?
It was great. I thought it was a blast. I did feel like I got around quite a lot. You know, it's like the marathon run around and around. I don't know how many times I worked the floor, but within a span of an hour, I walked away with just too many records and too many posters.
Oh my God, you guys were like competing at one point. Somebody bought a Kindred record, guys.
Yeah,
that was me.
Fucking Rob G over here. He just pulls it out and he's like, oh, Ryan, I got a Kindred. And I'm like, motherfucker.
What you said was, I was like, I don't know about this Kindred. And you're like, Rob G, if you put that down, it's mine.
I will buy it.
Oh my Lord.
So I bought Kindred out of spite, Turek.
And then, you know, what was great is I did find a Halloween 4 record.
Did you get it?
No.
Oh, yeah, because you were debating
it. I was debating. By Sunday morning, it was gone. And I was like, you know what?
For the best. I paid way too much for a Christine record, and it was the soundtrack, not the score,
right,
and had skips in it. So it's never sure deal, man.
You never know.
Never
know. I bought a vintage Gorgon video shirt, which I am so excited I will be. And I also bought a Sammy Kerr shirt that was not vintage.
Oh, yes, I saw that Sammy Kerr
shirt. Yeah, it was right across from us. I stared at it the whole time, and then by Sunday I was like, I need a motherfucking Sammy Kerr shirt. So I went over and got it.
What about you, Elric? You like rolled in like halfway through the convention like a rock star and jumped on stage.
All I know is I bought a Suspiria t-shirt I'm now wearing from Claudio Simonetti. I don't think it's much better than that. Like when you hand Claudio Simonetti cash and he gives you this goblin shirt, you're like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. The fun thing, what you're saying about having fun, I think part of it was because we were so heavily involved. Like, they used us in a way that we were constantly, one of us was constantly doing something.
We were
and I actually
on
think that worked really well because it kept you just super active.
All right, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Best behind the scenes moment before you took the stage to moderate a panel? Go around the table. I want to ask.
Oh, God. Well, for me, I never saw, apparently there was a quote unquote green room where people waited.
Yeah.
I never saw this green room.
Nope.
I moderated like five panels.
Oh, yeah,
so for example, before Bates Motel, I got to meet Freddie Highmore briefly through Sean Clark. And they're like, yeah, the whole cast is in the green room. Why don't you go meet him? And I was like, I don't know where the hell that is. So I'm just like waiting there because also it was so packed that like if you left, I feel like they wouldn't have let me back in wherever I went.
Right.
So Ryan Hurst, who I was added at the last minute, he plays Chick on the show, but he's on Sons of Anarchy. He's like, you know, freaking
tall dude,
6'5" or whatever. He's like a giant. Yeah. So he comes like up back there. It's just the two of us. And I'm like, hi, are you Ryan? He's like, who wants to know?
Oh, Jesus.
I'm Rob. I'm doing the panel. He's like, yeah? Question mark. I'm like, all right, this is going to go just great. But, you know, it was actually funny. And I'm shout out to our friend Dustin Sane, who shot a good chunk of the panels and posted them on YouTube. Once we got on stage, me and Ryan actually were poking fun at each other the entire time. And there's some pretty good improv there. I mean, one thing is he was talking about his character and he was just saying something like, I just wanted you to not know whether you should laugh or be terrified. And without missing a beat, I was like, that's how I feel right now. I don't know whether to laugh or be terrified by you. So we had a lot of fun. It was good. But that was my
surprising behind the scenes, which is there because as I told Rob, like when I got there, it's hard to make me nervous because I'm constantly in front of people, whatever I'm doing, whether it's my job or whatever. But I was genuinely nervous about doing the Suspiria panel because even though I know the film inside out, they're saying about the language barrier and I knew how much it would mean to certain, like me as a fan, if I was in that thing and some guy fucked that up and I traveled all the way for that, I'd be pissed off. So we're all behind the scenes. I've just met Dario Simonetti, two actresses from the film. And why can't we take the stage? Who would be late from that scenario? Oh, the guy who has one fucking line in the movie, Udo fucking Kier. And they're all like, oh, we're waiting for Udo. And everyone's just sitting around going, yeah, we can't go on. Udo's not here. And I'm like, oh, Jesus. The guy has one line. Can't we just go up? So eventually Udo just rolls in. And you would think he is the fucking star of this movie. The way he even takes on the panel, he's just like, oh, no, it's Udo's movie. That line could totally – I mean, it's a great line, but that scene totally could be out of the film.
Yeah, Ryan and we're sitting in for that panel for Suspiria, which you did a great job. And also, I know you were nervous because Dario doesn't speak well English, but I thought he spoke way better than I was anticipating.
Yeah,
but we were specifically waiting because I knew you were asking how everybody got involved in the movie. So waiting for Udo's first response, and it did not disappoint.
Well, because I had read just recently that he was in bed with Fassbender. And I was like, oh, shit, when he found out about Suspiria coming to town. And it was Fassbender said, you should go do that movie. And I'm like, well, that's a story. I want to hear that.
Wow.
But also Debbie Sue Voorhees. I gave her a Friday 13th Part 5 necklace that Selena made,
which and I took a picture of.
Which I haven't gotten those photos yet, but
you can have them.
But I'm just like, you know, you can't see my hands, but who do you want to see from the Friday 13th wearing a beautiful necklace? It's Debbie Sue Voorhees, so she seemed really happy about it. So that was cute, you know.
That was great.
Wilford Brimley was a fucking. He just tore it up, man.
He looked like a firecracker.
He was a firecracker.
He was not putting up with shit.
No, he wasn't. It was amazing because he wrote. We didn't know he was in a motorized wheelchair.
We call it a rascal.
A rascal. He was in a rascal. So
he comes
pulling up in a rascal, and everybody's like, oh, my God, we didn't know. We got to get him on stage. And I was like, look, I'll stand on the floor with him.
Oh, yeah.
And then we could just, like, look up to everybody on the stage. And he pulls up to the side of the stage. Someone hands him a mic. He goes, I can get up the goddamn stairs. And then he's like, "It's how many steps?" I'm like, 3. And he's like, got it. And he just started climbing the stairs. It was amazing. You did. You also had an Udo panel.
No, so that was my weirdest behind the scenes moment was on scene. So that was Udo Kier, who I was doing.
It was on the stage. It was happening.
The Puppet Master panel, which though I was worried about, Dread Central just put up an article about a half an hour ago about how it was the best panel of the entire convention because of how crazy it was. With a lovely picture of me next to Udo. So, yeah, we start the panel, and it's on the new Puppet Master, and it's Charlie Band and the producer and the guy who did the effects for the new Puppet Master and one of the actors and Udo, who plays Toulon. He's the Puppet Master.
Right.
What is this madness?
I know. And so he rolls in late again, but he comes bearing all these pictures. And one of them is him as a cowboy from a film. And he keeps holding it up going, look at me. I'm a cowboy.
Oh,
I'm a Texan.
No.
And but so we're doing the panel. And midway, not even midway, like maybe 2 minutes in, like, you know, somebody across the room is talking. Udo starts massaging my shoulders. And it's really
Where's
weird.
Where's HR?
Yeah. And
where is that Texas primary HR?
I turn around and I'm just kind of like trying to be, you know, professional during this Udo Kier back rub. And I'm like, oh, Udo, I feel so much better now. And he goes, I likes your apple tree because I have an apple tree tattoo on my back. And then he starts patting it and interrupting everything, just going, apple tree.
Oh.
Apple tree is talking. And so he keeps doing that. And after like a few minutes, I'm like, whew, Udo, I am so relaxed now. Thanks for that. And he stops for a few minutes at that point.
Wow.
But then he makes a comment about, and remember, Charles Band is on this panel. So Udo says, we were asking about, you know, have you seen the whole Puppet Master? Had you seen all the early films? And he was like, I saw the first one, but I didn't watch any of the others because they are crap and only for money.
Oh.
And, you know, Charles Band's, like, sitting, like, right there. And you just see Charles' face. It just, like, it was beautiful. And then Charles said something later where somebody was discussing part three, and he was like, but apparently it was made only for money. And I was like, go, Charles. But, yeah, Udo was just in rare form on that panel, just letting things go. Told us a story about a gladiator who carried him home from the bar the night before. This is on the panel, so
I can't talk about what happened at the bar the night before on this show, but it didn't end well.
If you remember, Ryan,
was a gladiator involved. I got
was
that.
In bad shape the night before. Let me tell you, but
the only clue we'll give you is that Ryan nipple licking story from way back. It's in that ballpark. We're in that ballpark.
Get the hell out.
We also all took a group field trip to have barbecue. I'm not a big meat fan, I will say. So I had some of the greatest grilled corn ever.
Meat.
But Ryan it was a like cafeteria tray that was just piled
so
with meat.
It was so delicious.
Yeah. And you guys were just like, you looked dead afterwards.
When in Texas. Texas Frymare was a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
And Lloyd, it's very well oiled machine. Great, you know, panels, great attendance, great fan base, and a lot of people. Thank you to everybody who came to the table and bought t-shirts and stickers and supported Blumhouse.
Meeting the listeners were awesome. Yeah. I loved Michelle was great. Seeing Freddie again was awesome. And we met a lot of celebrities who hopefully will be on the show. We made friends with Ted Raimi.
He was on our flight.
He was on our flight.
I had the entire cast of 31 on my plane.
Jeff Daniel Phillips is like my new chum. I love him. So we're going to get him on.
We had Tom Holland on our flight back. Me and Becca were on the same flight. And Tom's like,
delayed.
He's like, this is the most time I've spent with you guys in ages.
Yeah,
stuck at the airport.
Our flight was delayed like 5 hours. We're sitting in the airport with Tom Holland just talking. So it was
a lot of fun.
Awful.
Yeah.
But that was great. And Ryan, why don't you tell us about a little event that we co-hosted, Leatherface.
I was gonna just make a quick mention. Next time, guys, next time Overlook Film Festival happens, go. It was a great experience up at the Timberline Lodge, which is the the exterior is the lodge and the shining.
Cold.
It's very beautiful.
Can't we go as a group
20 foot,
and do what we
absolutely.
Do there?
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. 20-foot snowdrifts. It's amazing. But I was going to tie into what we saw with the screening, but we had a pretty – I'll get to that. I'll get to the screening because I want to talk about Leatherface because, seeing it on a big screen in 35mm, it was a blast.
Yeah.
But I want to do a little bit of housekeeping because we haven't done this in a while. I've noticed that our reviews and ratings have kind of gone quiet. So just a reminder to the listeners out there, don't forget to review, rate, and join us on social media. You can go on iTunes. Don't forget to star us. Don't forget to leave us a review. We're on Instagram, Shockwaves Podcast, Twitter, Shockwaves Pod, and on Facebook under Shockwaves. And upcoming events, Becca, you're going to...
I am at Phoenix Comic Con next week. I've got a couple of different panels. I'm doing trivia while I'm there. I'm doing a couple... They've got me doing a female in horror panel, which I will smile and do and say, it is forwarding females in horror. I will keep doing these until I hopefully don't have to.
You never know. Some person might be watching your panel, get inspired by
it. I know. That's what I want.
Yeah.
That's why I keep doing them. Though I keep saying,
don't be snarky about it, Becca.
I'm not being snarky. I'm saying we shouldn't have to do these things.
No, I agree.
But
I agree.
Will keep doing them because I do want to keep inspiring people. So. Yeah.
Well, it also just puts the spotlight on filmmakers. Nobody might have known if
it
you especially
does.
Have a,
it's the ground game.
Up there.
So,
we have a lot to catch up on before our guest.
I also have a booth there, by the way, but it's under Evil Squared Productions, so come find me for there because we're promoting some of our own stuff.
When is it?
It is a long con. It runs Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So
of next week.
Last
week in May.
Yeah, and it's massive, like over 100,000 attendees. It's
fantastic.
Huge. So
great. We have about that many movies to catch up on.
Just about.
Let's go around the table. Rob G, what do you got?
Let's see. I'm going to start with Mother's Day because Mother's Day passed in the interim. And I actually asked our group, what are you watching today? What's your Mother's Day inspired horror? I squeezed three movies in. I'll only touch on them briefly, but Serial Mom, which just came out from Scream Factory on Blu-ray.
Stuff, yeah.
I've always loved this movie. I think it is John Waters' best.
Yeah, it's his best film.
In terms of just direction, comedy, style, everything about it, I love from start to finish.
Yeah.
And I forgot because when I saw it, I was very young when I saw it. The thing that stood out to me as a kid was I loved that L7 was in it, the band L7, mm-hmm. as Camel Lips.
That's right. That's
and they
right,
actually yeah. had the props to, fulfill that name of yeah. their band. I'll leave that at that. But there are so many little things I forgot about. I forgot how funny Matthew Lillard is in it because he works – like so basically Kathleen Turner, it's like this very – 50s style, traditional, Leave It to Beaver family. Mm-hmm. And Kathleen Turner is the mother of the bunch and everything's so proper. And the boy, Matthew Lillard, works at the video store. So he's referencing Henry Porter of a Serial Killer.
There's a lot of Herschel Gordon
and,
Lewis.
And her, yeah. a lot of which blood feast. Fun, yeah. They're always watching Herschel Gordon Lewis movies, which I think is fantastic. But then, it's like Kathleen Turner is totally, completely psycho. But in a way that's so, I think it
she's
will appeal.
Pussy Willow.
Oh my God.
That's my favorite thing about that movie.
She does, the phony phone calls yeah. just to say the P word.
It's just so funny. It's totally, weird.
So there's that. And then anybody that she deems, the kid that doesn't wear the seatbelt, the one that broke her daughter's
Wearing white
after Labor Day. It's like all these like horrible, you didn't rewind the tape, you're going to get beaten with a leg of lamb. It's just like all these amazing things. I just forgot how outrageous this movie is and how funny and fun and great. So.
And how they eroticized Ted Bundy.
Let me put it to you. Sam Waterston, who plays the husband, I think he steals the show by being so square.
By being straight.
Oh my God. But there's a moment when he like digs into her stuff and he finds a tape from Ted Bundy and he's like, Beverly, I'm on death row and I'm so lonely.
Yeah, it's
and
so
you're just
great.
Like, oh my God, this movie is insane. But I really love it. And Scream Factory yet again did a great job. There's a great lengthy like a roundtable interview. I think it's at a hotel room. It's John Waters and Kathleen Turner and the one other, the girl that's on the phony fuggles, Mick Stahl, who's in a lot of his early films. Uh-huh. And it's great. It's just a candid chat about it. And like Kathleen Turner's like, oh, her husband at the time told her don't do it.
Oh,
and it's like, and now we're not married anymore.
How funny.
it's like little funny.
It's one of her best roles. I mean, that romancing and stuff.
I think it's one of the best things she's ever done. So Serial Mom gets my strongest recommendation. I also watched Psycho, the original, because Psycho is great Mother's Day movie. Don't say.
Psycho.
By the way, that remake came out. I'm sorry, but if you like the commentary, thank you. I read an article about what I learned from the commentary, including the one tidbit I forgot is that uncredited Rick Baker did Mother because they had to reshoot that whole scene at the end. And I was like, oh, that's kind of neat.
That's right.
And then I rounded it out with The Babadook, which I honestly have not seen since it came out.
Neither have I.
Someone recommended it. And I'm like, yeah, that's a Mother's Day movie. Sure.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Actually, I saw it with you, Ryan. Mm-hmm. I got an advanced screener of it and we watched it. And my memory was
I haven't seen it since then.
Yeah, it's much better than what we saw.
Yeah.
I think there might have been minor tweaks to it.
Oh, because, really?
Well, because I remember heavy reliance on CG in the cut we saw, and it didn't bother me as much this time around.
I'm way overdue to watch it myself.
Yeah,
so
me too. Let's both rewatch it.
The thing that stands out to me about it now is that has to be the most annoying kid character in film history.
Bob.
But well, no, I, you know what?
He is spawn of Bob.
I think this kid is worse than Bob.
I think the kid's Bob.
Bob, Bob.
And I don't know how any of you are parents.
Bob. I think he worked really well as a
who,
as
the kid.
I think the performance is great, and the annoying is so on purpose to get her.
Oh, yeah.
That it's so purposeful that I think it's great.
Oh, yeah. So it works on that level. Yeah. But no, it's you know what? It's a strong movie. The Babadook is not, if I counted it, the actual creature is not in the movie barely at all.
Yeah.
Maybe under 2 minutes tops. And I was so, it's funny how you remember these things.
Yeah.
I remember
there's
being so much
cosplay
more.
To remind you.
Yeah.
There was
and
some
I'm like,
beautiful cosplay that popped up over the weekend that everybody made go viral. It was a beautifully rendered version of the Babadook. And I was like, I don't remember seeing that
and
much
that's
of
the thing.
Him.
Yeah. This time, it's one frame. One frame of that face. And yet people are cosplaying as it.
Sure.
And you recognize it. And I'm like, how is it possible that it's a flash frame in the movie, and we all remember.
Yeah, he's mostly
well, think
in
about
paper.
Exorcist. Think about that face you see in Exorcist.
That's
a flash frame,
and you see
haunts
that.
You forever. Yeah. You know.
So that's my Mother's Day stuff. What did you guys watch?
nice.
If I was doing Mother's Day, I think the one I didn't rewatch it, I was anguished by, because Luna was the one everyone's got to watch, that crazy movie.
Oh, is that the one with Zelda Rubinstein?
Zelda Rubinstein. It's a crazy movie, amazing. But it's good for a Mother's Day.
It's 70s and really unknown.
Yeah, and it has a part where it tries to hypnotize you.
Oh, it's weird because it's a film about a film while they're watching a film. Yeah.
And a lot of eyeball imagery.
What's that called, Luna?
Biggest Luna's the director. It's called
Anguish.
Okay, so it's Twitterverse. Before you attack me, Serial Mom, Psycho, The Babadook, Anguish, Happy. All right, who's next?
One more time? No. I'll start with the newish film that I was super excited to talk about a couple weeks ago, but we haven't been here for a while. And it's one that, as Ryan said, when I told him I liked it, he said he goes to festivals and there's a certain box, the Elric box he ticks when he sees it.
Every single one, I have one.
This one's called A Dark Song by Liam Gavin.
Oh.
It's, you know, basically about a woman, a mother who's, you don't really understand fully why she's damaged, but, you know, she looks pretty broken when we introduce her. And it's very, one of the things I really like about the movie is how matter of fact it is. It doesn't feel necessarily like a horror film initially. And she basically is meeting a guy at a train station. It's the actor from Sightseers, who I thought was great in Sightseers. What is his name again?
Oh, it is him.
Yeah, it's Steve Orr.
That's right. Yeah.
And he is just one of the best film characters of this year, in my opinion. He comes in and he's just this kind of, he's the guy who would annoy you when you sit next to him at the New Beverly. And he's there every night and kind of smells, but he's obsessed and he has the same seat every time. That's the character.
He's a fucking Gamergate dude.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But he also just happens to be this occultist, and as it unfolds between them, she will do anything, literally anything. She rents this giant house, pays a fortune for it up front to rent it. She will do anything to try – you don't really know what. I'm not going to ruin what it is, but something to do with her son is dead, and that's up front. She's lost someone, and you don't know whether it's to commune with him or for some other act. He pushes her. It's almost like, basically, you could almost say it's whiplash for occultists, because it's that person who's going to throw the symbol at your head and say, you know, you're off rhythm, and it's a crazy – how they keep – it's a movie built on repetition of this idea. It pushes the boundaries between them. You're not sure whether this is really going to even go to become a horror film or whether it's going to be about the process of trying. I did say to Becca at one point it struck me as a feature-length version of Bobby that we've talked about a lot, that short film.
It doesn't end like Bobby or anything.
Yeah, it has a very similar concept up front. It goes to one of the most – you know, this won't ruin anything. Goes to one of the most surprising endings to any movie I've ever seen in my entire life. I don't even know if I liked it at the time, the ending, but I'll tell you what, I have thought about this movie every day since I saw this movie. So that's to me a sign, kind of like February. The one movie I'd compare it to in terms of feeling, like if it's this year's thing, I'd call it This Year's Invitation, because it's an adult film, adult horror film for a serious kind of minded horror.
What I would add to that, though, is that, you know, you use Black Coat's Daughter and The Invitation as two, you know, kind of reference points, but I feel like A Dark Song has more of a motor behind it that those who think, you know, The Invitation and Black Coat's Daughter are a little bit too slow, A Dark Song actually has momentum to it.
Really?
It actually
keeps people going. That.
Really?
Yeah, because
there's constantly something happening.
When it goes to a place that does.
Or maybe it was just I didn't enjoy it as much, because I was good with – Black Coat's Daughter wasn't my favorite film of the year, but I definitely enjoyed it, and I really loved Invitation. But Dark Song for me, I was just kind of – it didn't – I guess it was the repetition. I was like, oh, we're doing this again.
Yeah.
And this again. And this again. And I understand that why it's in there. And it definitely weighed on my soul. Like the movie, I left it the same way where I was thinking about it. But it was not my cup of tea because it was so claustrophobic. You're literally staring at two people for the entire movie.
But a lot does happen. Like, don't be put off by the idea that you think it's just going to be two people in a room. It really isn't.
That's exactly what I'm getting at.
No.
Yeah. It kind of goes to, what was that Turkish horror film? Baskin. There's a moment where I was like, oh, that's a little Baskin-y.
It
like,
does get
crazy.
Baskin-y,
you know?
Yeah, it does get kind of crazy.
But
Baskin-y.
It will definitely be in my top couple of the year. It's one of the few films I feel like I'm going to have to see again, because where it goes is surprising, and it's cool to see a horror film. I mean, the other thing that crossed my mind is like, man, if they make a third Conjuring, please call this guy, because I think he could scare the piss out of people if he was given a big movie, just because he grounded it so well.
I did like how atmospheric it was in that because it is like this giant house, there's like nothing in the house. Mm-hmm. Like, it just feels empty.
But
there's like a atmosphere in the mm-hmm. fact that there is nothing in the house.
It's just like the minutiae of everything. Yeah. Every detail is laid out. There's always something going on.
Of ceremony, like, too.
No, that's what I'm talking about. It's the procedure. Yeah. It's yes. the minutiae of like exactly why you need to do this and exactly how you're supposed to do
that's
things.
That's the word. He's yeah. nailed the word. So if you like things like The Wire and that, yeah. it's the horror version of yes. that. Yeah. It's the procedural.
Yeah. I also really liked their approach to the supernatural, that it wasn't just yeah. like, oh, you want to, you know, do this. Oh, well, all you got to do is draw a pentagram yeah. on the ground and slash your
right.
palm.
It was much more like,
oh, no, this takes years and yeah. we must get started now and it's going to take years and you have yeah. to do stuff every day. Yeah. It was much more like
I think it's
process.
Really captivating. I yeah. think people, you know, just listen and check it out. I think it's definitely, even if you don't necessarily think you'll like it, check it out, because I think this one I think is one worth
absolutely.
Talking about.
I feel know? Like we should do kind of like what Fangoria used to do back in the day, where they'd have like their critic pick.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
know, and I feel like each episode we should have at least one that's like yeah. overall unanimous. All we right. all put see the seal one. Approval mm-hmm. on it. Mm.
That's a rarity, though.
Yeah.
yeah, yeah. And this is one that, and I think we've been talking about, like, if we ever do start doing a couple little spoiler things where we post a little bonus thing of a spoiler, I would love to
that
talk about this
one because okay. there is so much you can't talk about that will right. ruin
a
it.
A dark song.
Dark song. And it's on VOD now.
Cool.
So while we were at Texas Frightmare, we all hung out at the Vinegar Syndrome booth a lot.
Oh, yes.
Uh-oh.
And
what did you get?
They sent me home. I was really excited because they had Avenging Disco Godfather, which I used to watch all the time mm-hmm. in college and absolutely loved some Rudy Ray Moore action.
I know where this is going.
So I watched Petey Wheatstraw.
Oh, I'm curious to see that one.
I saw this at the New Bev.
Oh, which wow.
One? Oh, you did?
Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's son-in-law.
Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's son-in-law. So I was there and I was like, oh, Avenging Disco Godfather. If I talk about this on the show, the guys will yell at me because it's not horror. And he was like, then you need some Petey Wheatstraw yeah. action. And so I took
have
home
you guys not seen this?
I know about it. I've seen stills.
I still don't know what you're saying. Petey Wheatstraw?
It's
Rudy
Wheatstraw.
Ray Moore, one
there's
of
a really
his
good
other
song.
Films.
Petey Wheatstraw.
The Devil's yeah, Son-in-Law.
The Devil's Son-in-Law. It's Rudy Ray Moore. It is from 1977. This is definitely one of the lesser known exploitation, blaxploitation yeah. films. Mm-hmm. Definitely one of the lesser known horror blaxploitation films as well. But I do have to say it was a pretty fascinating watch.
I feel like it's a crowd movie. You need to see it with a crowd.
I watched it with Dave and it was still pretty damn amusing. Especially because midway through the film, Dave just looks at me and he goes, Becca, this is fucking Pootie Tang. And it is. It's like beat for beat Pootie Tang. Oh. But it's pre-Pootie Tang.
I like that you know every beat of Pootie Tang.
I know. Oh. Instead of the belt, he has a pimp cane. So the whole plot of it is that Petey Wheatstraw is just this badass guy. The whole thing's set in L.A. Like, we were even looking up the locations, and a lot of the locations are still here. So, like, you can go on a Petey Wheatstraw set visit. But yeah, so he's just this badass guy in Los Angeles. He knows kung fu, very standard Rudy Ray Moore stuff. He has a whole assortment of ladies who follow him around, but one in particular, he's got an entourage. And then the devil comes to him and says, Petey Wheatstraw, you're in some problems with some gangsters. I will get you out of this problem and give you a magical pimp cane if you agree to marry my ugly ass daughter. And Petey Wheatstraw says, okay, I'll
deal.
Do it. I'll marry your ugly ass daughter. Get back to me in a week. And so then he says, okay, cool. Get back to me in a week. I'm going to go take my magical pimp cane and go do good things around the ghetto. And he does. And that's like the happy kind of Pootie Tang
so
part
awesome.
Of the movie. And then the devil comes back. And then it gets kind of crazy. But yeah, great soundtrack.
How do they portray the devil?
He is wearing a tracksuit in scenes. He's just an elderly guy in a tracksuit. Uh-huh. And there's scenes where he's like, he's just jogging through and he'll be like, Petey, come with me. We're going to go talk to this guy. So yeah, he's just a dude in a tracksuit.
So if you watch a dark song and it's not for you, clearly this one will be for you because I think we've shown where we land.
Petey Wheatstraw.
Yeah, it's a comedy. I'm inclined to call it racist, but since it's
made by... It's
yeah,
you can't take these movies out of their
context,
really.
You just kind of say, you know, right. There's context there, yeah. So.
Rudy Ray Moore does rule. I gotta say, he is a pretty awesome dude.
You need to see Avenging Disco Godfather, because that was my jam in college.
Cool.
It was
so
awesome.
Good. I
gotta
see it.
I'll flash back to last weekend, we presented a screening of Leatherface, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 with Friday Night Frights at the Cine Family. And we had Ken Forey in attendance. We had David J. Scow. We had Billy Butler. And it was a fantastic evening. We began with the teaser for Leatherface, and then we brought out the producer and the producer of that teaser and his son, who brought the actual chainsaw from the teaser trailer and a replica of the chainsaw.
Sean Farini.
Yeah, Sean. And it was a great. It was just a great night. I had never seen Leatherface's Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 on the big screen before.
No, so I don't think I have either.
Yeah,
that was we went.
We did.
You and I saw it.
You guys saw it with the when
but
Brian
I thought
Collins
I watched the. Oh, and then that's
and
right.
Then
we
watched
the.
Yeah,
because
no,
I loved watching the uncut one.
Yeah. So Brian Collins had done it before. I think was it at NewBev when you guys saw it?
Yeah.
But I had never seen it, and that's the whole kind of impetus behind doing a Blumhouse Friday Night Frights screening. It's just kind of find stuff that I've never seen before on the big screen. We're working out our next screening event, but Leatherface is such an interesting sequel, and while it is chopped down to death, it's still an immensely enjoyable sequel. It's a lot of fun. The heavy metal that kicks in just like ratchets things up. Viggo Mortensen is fantastic. The cast is terrific. There's a lot of just like slimy characters that drip off the screen.
The family are great. I really
like the family.
Yeah.
The family dynamic, because you've got the mother, you've got the little girl.
Do you know who
girl.
The mother is? No. That's John Gallagher's mom.
Yeah, are it's you serious?
Yes, it's John Gallagher's mom.
No
yes.
way.
Oh my gosh, cool did Clue come to the screening?
Oh my God.
I know. Isn't that
God.
Crazy? It's one of those things where I found that out. I was like, oh.
Mind blown.
So she's also from The Offspring, you know, from Whisper to a Scream. Yeah, she's the sister.
Wow.
Of
that was actually his wife?
That was his wife. Playing his sister in the movie, but that's his
God.
Wife.
God, and she's like brave as shit. She gets like totally naked in that. Oh
yeah, but
God.
She's got the weird voice thing in that movie.
In the voice box.
Isn't that cool? That's one of those great little things.
That's fantastic. I mean, you know, she's surrounded by some other great actors. Joe Unger, you know, Tom Everett, who plays Alfredo. Who's the gas station attendant, who's just the most annoying
he's amazing.
Family member from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre verse.
He's the updated version of the hitchhiker.
Basically, yeah. Such a pain in the ass, that guy. it was great to hear stories from Ken. It was great to hear stories from David directly from his mouth, right from his mouth. You know, he just commands the room,
but yeah,
tells you the way it is.
My favorite thing is David kicked it off by saying, so this was the worst Texas Chainsaw sequel until the next one.
Yeah.
So aren't there stories about reshoots where Ken Foray and that they're fighting and Six Flags is right behind them? Apparently there are shots where you could see Six Flags.
Yeah, you could see Six Flags.
About that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. Ken was talking about how they brought, like, you know, spoiler, they brought him back for a different ending where he just, would, you know, has a Band-Aid on his head practically.
Yeah. I know, that's so weird.
But the whole audience laughed when that happened because they're like, oh, but I buy it because it's Betty. It's fun.
And he broke Viggo's ribs or broke a rib.
Oh, really?
Viggo didn't tell him.
Yeah, Viggo didn't tell him.
Because he was so new, he's like, oh, I'm not going to tell him. Here's
a great thing.
We did
try to get Viggo, and Viggo, there was interest. Like, he was actually interested. He had heard about it. He was like, oh, that's cool. When is it? Like, and let me see. Can you just talk to my manager? And we did put in a request to his manager, and his manager's like, God damn, guys, he's like shooting in Europe. And we're like, oh.
He's probably making Easter promises, too. With Herdeberg.
Yeah.
He probably is. Probably. That was all lined up.
Oh, wow.
That was for real happening.
Yeah. And we tried to get R.A. Mihailov, who plays Leatherface, but he now lives on the East Coast now.
Yeah.
It was just an overall, it was just a great night. But Leatherface, definitely one of my, you know, I have great memories of it.
It's just a
lot of fun, you know.
Yeah, that uncut version that's DVD, I really wish somebody would
Could
do a
Blu-ray
of it.
Could there be a print of that out there?
No,
there is no print.
Okay.
No. There's no print of the uncut version.
What we saw was the print.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's a shame. What a shame. Because that part really is intense, some of that gore.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. I rather like that version of it,
yeah. Just the act of the little girl doing what she does.
It changes the whole context.
It changes the whole context.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah. Let's see. For me, here's a pickup from Texas Frightmare over from our friends at Severn Films. They just put out from 1973 Blackenstein.
Oh,
yeah, they did.
And they sold out of it.
They did sell out.
Like
I tried to go back for one.
Yeah. So this movie, I love Blackula, but that's like a. That's like a legitimately good, like,
that
Dracula horror movie.
It's a really well-made film.
Real
and that guy's a
real
really
actor,
good movie.
Yeah, even though it's got a blaxploitation title, it's actually like a really legitimate, scary horror movie, you know? But this is actually, you know, like a schlocky blaxploitation movie. And I've had DVD versions of it in the past that just kind of looked like VHS versions. So I've actually never made it through this film. But that's the thing I like is, especially with a lot of these companies these days, is they'll get these old school movies and restore them in a way that's like, I can't believe this looks right. as good as it does.
Like it's never looked that good, even when I was playing on a screen.
So,
yeah. you know?
So Blackenstein is spectacular in terms of its appearance. It is well, and there's two cuts of the film as they always do. And I tweeted last night and it got a retweet from Severin, so I assume this was a compliment. I'm like, this movie is both terrible and simultaneously amazing. That's the only way I could put it.
It exists.
It exists, and it was directed by a guy named William A. Levy. And I actually kind of like the plot. I mean, it's, you know, this guy that came back from Vietnam and he like lost his arms and legs. So he's in a hospital and his girlfriend is now working for this doctor that's doing all this experimental treatment with, you know, with different patients. So she volunteers him to kind of do this thing. But then the other lab technician is in love with her. So he tampers with the DNA, you know, for the experiment. And he like obviously kind of like hulks out. And becomes just like giant Black Frankenstein and wreaks havoc. It's not bad, but what's funny is like when he actually goes out and attacks people, that's when it gets really schlocky because the way it's shot and stuff. But they put these like, there's like these weird sound effects that actually make it kind of effective. Like he'll attack somebody and you'll see like the silhouette of an arm getting ripped off and he's like, ugh. And you're like, oh, that was kind of spooky, I guess. So it's not a great movie, but if you like this sort of thing, you'll enjoy it. The thing that's great about this disc, though, is the special features, because this was written and produced by a guy named Frank R. Seletri. And he was like a very famous lawyer, Hollywood lawyer. And he had written, but he was a huge horror fan. He lived in Bela Lugosi's house in Hollywood Hills.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And not only did he write Blackenstein, he wrote dozens and dozens of scripts for movies that were never made, such as Black the Ripper and Black Frankenstein Meets the White Werewolf. Wow. All films I wish existed.
Black the Ripper is pretty catchy.
Yeah, there was cool stuff, but he got killed. He was executed like monster
Jesus.
Style.
Bury the lead.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it was weird. Well, so there's actual newsreel footage of them reporting his death.
Oh, wow.
There's an interview with his sister talking about who he was and all that kind of stuff.
He got killed here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, yeah. He, like somebody, nobody knows. To this day, it's still unsolved because he had so many ties in the Hollywood community, but at the same time, like he represented, you know, it went everywhere from like Hollywood people to mobsters to you know, to prostitutes. And
what
like,
was his name again?
Frank Seletri.
Becca's cooking up a story.
He wrote and produced Blackenstein.
So you can tune into next week's Our Strange World podcast, which will be about Frank Seletri.
but really, that's the most fascinating thing about this is all the special features are about this guy and his life. And I mean, you know, this horror fanatic that bought Bela Lugosi's house and was like a hotshot Hollywood lawyer. And then I don't know who he pissed off or what, but then he got killed and they still haven't solved it. And that's the weird thing is that, you know, he was like a black belt in karate. He had weapons in his house. So it's like, did he know the people that did it? You know, the true crime behind it is equally as fascinating. So you're getting quite a bit for that Blackenstein disc, let me tell you.
I am sure that's the most anyone's ever spoken of Blackenstein. Wow. I think that's a good thing. You've started the ball rolling.
Blackenstein.
Interesting.
What you got, Kane?
I'll just do two back-to-back because they're quick. 27 by 40, the new poster documentary. Yeah. I watched it just before we got down to Texas, so it was cool to actually then see, you know, talk to people like Gary Pullen and that while we're there. It was, you know, it's a well-made, a very simple documentary about, you know, the loss of illustrative art, especially in Hollywood, but then its resurgence through Mondo. The stuff about Mondo was the most interesting because I'm somebody who, you know, besides the buying frenzy that they create, I don't know much about the process of how they have to get the titles legitimately. And then you have some people who get them legitimately and they're kind of pissed at the ones who do it illegally because they're these limited runs. And like all of us as fans, obviously sometimes we'll complain, why is it so expensive? It sells out, then it goes for a fortune. But then they have the point that it is art. You know, they are trying to keep it as art, not just poster reproductions. And I really also like that element to it. So it's an interesting kind of dual argument. Obviously, they're very pro. It's a very pro, you know, Mondo World documentary. And I actually really enjoyed it. And there's a great part on one of my favorite movies of all time is Night of the Hunter. And they Phantom, I think they're called Phantom City
Phantom
Productions.
Creative.
Yeah, Phantom Creative. They made this poster with Mitchum and his face is in the light and there's the boat in the bottom. And then they talk about, well, but then Mitchum's estate basically said, we couldn't have Mitchum's likeness. So how do you do Night of the Hunter? So they put the shadow right across all of his face. So all you see is his eyes. And it makes the poster a 1,000 times cooler because of a creative limitation. And then as soon as the documentary ended, I bought that motherfucker from eBay. It had cost me more than I would like to spend, but it was like the last one. I was like, okay, good. So, you know, it worked. This documentary will make you spend money, so be careful. But I liked it. I thought that was a pretty interesting one. And then I watched from the opening Shudder ad, Sweet Sweet Lonely Girl, which I wrote down in my notes. It's Jean Roland's House of the Devil, which is basically the two vibes you're getting. It's a more Roland-esque girl-on-girl kind of film version of a House of the Devil attempt. It's not as successful as House of the Devil, but I really enjoyed the vibe of the movie. I enjoyed the pace of it. It doesn't have the kind of payoff that, you know, would make it to me a classic, but it makes you want to know what the guy would do next with, you know, a bigger budget and stuff. It's definitely, I think it's perfect for Shudder. Like, it's the reason why I think this goes hand in hand with the one you guys did with Hush, in the sense of these movies that by bypassing the theater, I think it's actually the right move for a movie like this, the size, because to waste the money on advertising of a movie like this seems like it's only going to lead to a disappointment. But going straight to a service like that, I enjoyed seeing it that way. And there's not a lot of movies I feel that usually I want to see something theatrically. I thought this was the perfect way to see it and discover it. So I'm really glad that Shudder is doing it with movies like this. It'll probably help more of these sized movies get made. Totally. But I liked it. I thought the acting's really good. The main actress, this young blonde girl, I think who won, I think she is also made a directorial debut that played at Tribeca, that won Tribeca, and she's like 16 or something. I was watching this, there's a side story about her, and it was this big deal because she made I think the movie cost like $10,000 or something. It's like, you know, unrelated, but I haven't seen that film, so I can't really tell you. But those ones I've been watching.
Aaron Wilhelmy?
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting.
Yeah, we'll post an update on that.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I saw that at Fantastic Fest last year, and I was just captivated by it. It's just this tone and rhythm,
What's it called again?
Sweet, Sweet Lonely Girl?
Sweet, Sweet Lonely. I'm just reminding you guys.
Way to go.
I read it down the first time, but yes.
Becca, anything else?
Yeah, I'll throw two in there. First, I'm just going to say really quick that I've been loving American Gods. I don't even know if it technically qualifies as horror, but
I talked about it, so
it's got some scary-ass shit in it, but yeah, I have been absolutely loving it. The visuals, that's what I was not expecting. Like, I don't want to say it's really digital, but there are things in there that I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. Like, somehow they will take the most horrifying scene ever, cross-cut it with a Xerox machine, and it just ups it. And you're like, I don't even know what's going on, but this is brilliant. So, yeah, there's just so much going on in that I love. So, yeah, it's totally Brian Fuller. Like,
I can't wait to see it.
His signature is all over this thing. But the movie I'll talk about is The Dismembered from 1962. So this one I discovered actually because of Jared Rivet. So we were doing kind of our roundup for trivia prizing this month, and Jared had sent this email to Garage House Pictures. And I hadn't heard of them before, and he was like, you know, can we get a couple copies of your new releases? And they were like, yeah, we'll send over Dismembered. You guys have to check it out. And so the box of prizing arrives, and I'm like, what are you? I've never seen you before. From 1962. And it is a horror comedy, which I have to say, the score and the opening credits are the things that I will take away. The opening credits are very self-aware, like Deadpool style opening credits, and they're animated and they're amazing. Mm. The entire movie is scored with this improvisational jazz score, unlike anything I've ever heard before. It's really funky and piano heavy and fun. The movie itself was made by this guy, Ralph Hirshhorn, and he made it right outside of Philadelphia as soon as he graduated college in the early 60s, and made it for a couple of grand, finished it, and then as soon as he finished the movie, he got a job at Columbia Pictures as a line producer, left for Hollywood, never really did anything with the movie, and like 50 years later, he was moving and somebody picked it up in his attic and was like, what's this? And he's like, oh, it's my feature film. And so they kind of uncovered it then and re-released it. And Garage House Pictures put this out. And the movie itself, it does have, I'm going to say, a Manos Hands of Fate charm to it. You are looking at a low-budget horror comedy. Definitely, you know, people still die with their eyes crossed and everything like that. But it does have a sense of charm to it, and it does have some seriously funny moments. It's community theater level of acting, just because that's what he had access to. I'm pretty sure he actually used some people from, like, the local community theater.
People are buying this on Amazon like crazy.
I know.
If you, by chance, just happen to, like, you know, really want something that's kind of quirky out of the 60s that I guarantee you have never seen before, Check out The Dismembered. I was pleasantly surprised by it. And the score, again, improvisational jazz, I was kind of into it.
I love this tagline on the box. It says, a really weird movie that will make you sick, sick, sick.
It's a really good tagline.
That is a good
and
cover.
I do have to say, for 1962 kind of traditional film, there is a scene at the end where the characters start getting chased around by all these body parts. So it's like a bloody brain and a hand and a foot. And, you know, it actually, it feels kind of, you know, gory for the time period. So
that's nice.
Wow.
Well, because I know all of our listeners out there were waiting for my wrap up on the Wishmaster series. I want to talk about Wishmaster 3, Beyond the Gates of Hell.
Must
and
Ryan.
Wishmaster 4, The Prophecy
Better.
Fulfilled. And the
your
first,
prophecy has been fulfilled.
I
and
have.
You will hear
I have. Now the gates of hell are opening and my soul is right. doomed. Wishmaster 3 and 4 were actually done back to back and released in 2001 and 2002 from director Chris Angel, not the magician.
Oh, man, that would have been so much cooler.
I know.
The first one is basically what I call Wishmaster on campus. AJ Cook from Final Destination 2 stars.
Oh.
Sean Connery, Jason Connery, son of Sean Connery is the Wishmaster this time.
So does he go to college?
He does go to college.
Wishmaster
he poses.
Goes to college?
He poses as a professor.
How and devious of him!
I know this is actually pretty terrible, guys. just a heads up.
What are you expecting?
Because Wishmaster
otherwise?
1 started here. Wishmaster 2 is like okay, tolerable. I got it. Wishmaster 3 is a total piece of shit.
Don't
be a boring Wishmaster movie.
But definitely still get the box set because it's totally worth it.
Oh, no. This is, you can get all 1, 2, 3, and 4 through the Lionsgate Vestron series.
Which is a great box set, regardless of 3.
I'm very happy I
have a feeling that it's going to ramp up for 4. I just have a feeling
just
with
wait,
you.
Just wait. Wishmaster 3 is incredibly boring, but what I think they make the mistake of doing is introducing fucking angels. Like, angels are actually part of the war on the
djinn. Do they go to college, too?
No, unfortunately. Oh. It's all set around a campus. So anyways, it's boring. It doesn't have great inspired kills like 1 and 2 did. Jason Connery, not a great Wishmaster. AJ Cook, easy on the eyes, does her best. And then there's another Canadian. They did both of these in Canada, so you could see all the Canadian actors rolling out from the Ginger Snaps movies and all the local television shows. Wishmaster 4 is quite the gem. I do have to say,
didn't see that coming,
there's no sarcasm.
There's no sarcasm.
He said that
so
with a straight face.
I entered into Wishmaster 4 going, 3 is such a slog, man. Let me just, all right, here we go. And what I was introduced to was a marital drama about a girl who found the love of her life. They move into a new house. He gets into a terrible motorcycle accident. And he loses the use of his legs.
Okay.
So now he's wheelchair bound. Their marriage is strained. Things kind of suck. And then she comes across the Wishmaster. The Prophecy Fulfilled subtitle ties into this kind of epic thing in which if you're the one who awakens the djinn and he grants you all 3 wishes, tell on earth, baby. Mm. And guess what? He does. He grants all 3 of her wishes. And it's Michael Trucco from Battlestar Galactica and our very own Hush playing the Wishmaster this time. He grants all 3 wishes, but he's not ready to unleash his minions because he fell in love with her.
Oh.
And you know
an
what?
Like a melodrama.
It's a super, it's a little trifecta, man. It's a love triangle. And naturally, she's falling in love with the Wishmaster because her wheelchair-bound husband can't deliver the goods. It becomes a big sexual drama. It's a huge thing,
pretty intense
man.
For Wishmaster.
It's pretty intense.
Have you seen this one?
There's
a
lot more than meets the eye with this one. And
Douglas Sirk's Wishmaster, who it sells itself.
And then, of course, they introduce this angel who runs around and has a really deep voice. Literally 30 minutes into the movie, my girlfriend and I said, they're packing a lot in. It feels like we just watched like 80 minutes of a Wishmaster movie and only 30 minutes have passed. So, guys, do yourself a favor. Watch the Wishmasters in this order. 1, 2, 4, and then 3. Tell them I sent you.
Is there any connective tissue that you would need from 3? Is it
not at all?
Okay.
Not at all. So, yeah.
Wow.
Wishmaster 3
That's
and 4, guys.
Okay. Thank God you'll never have to talk about these ever again. I
honestly wanted to put together a Wishmaster Wishathon.
Oh, God.
Oh, but do it for the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
One of my favorite ideas I've ever had.
And bring out and roll out every single gin and have them meet these kids, man. Like,
because all the kids want to meet the Wishmasters.
They want to meet fucking Chris Pratt and Captain America.
Yeah. Yeah, but the Wishmaster, I mean, that's like every kid's dream is to meet the Wishmaster from part three.
Ryan, your heart is in the right place.
I like the idea. It's a good concept.
Telling you. Maybe our guest can help us get that going. We'll just like raise some bucks.
The Wishmaster Wishathon.
I appreciate that.
Right. Well, cool. Is there anything else you guys saw?
There's a lot. There's a few films from Overlook that I want to eventually talk about, and I'll roll them out because they're not released. Yeah, some of them don't have distribution, but I do want to put them on your radar. So we'll do it in future episodes. But there was one gem that I am so excited to talk about. We'll do it next week.
All right, that sounds good to me. I'm very excited for our guests. So we're going to take a quick little break and hear our sponsorship again, and we'll be right back.
Yay. Today's sponsor is Shudder, the premium streaming video service devoted to horror, thrillers, and suspense. Backed by AMC Networks, Shudder has a growing and dynamic selection of thrilling premieres, originals, and exclusives, including pregnancy horror comedy Prevenge, The Ring vs. The Grudge, franchise matchup Sadako vs. Kyako, and We Are the Flesh.
New and exclusive to Shudder is the stylish and atmospheric Sweet Sweet Lonely Girl. When Adele is sent to look after her Aunt Dora, she finds her aunt won't leave her room and barely speaks. So when Adele meets the seductive Beth, her lonely life improves for the first time. After Beth pushes her to shirk her duties, however, Adele faces a dangerous reckoning. Who is Beth and what does she want from Adele?
From performances to visual style, A.D. Calvo's Clear Supernatural's Chiller evokes the eerie atmosphere of the 70s and 80s horror in much the same way Ty West did with House of the Devil.
Sweet Sweet Lonely Girl had its world premiere at Fantastic Fest last September and is now streaming only on Shudder.
Shudder is available on the web, iOS, Android, Chromecast, Apple TV, and Roku for $4.99 a month or $49.99 for an annual membership. But Shockwave listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at the checkout.
Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of horror available to stream anywhere.
Welcome back to the show. We're pretty excited about this guest because after 140 episodes of Killer POV and now 50 episodes of Shockwaves, somebody we wanted to have on, somebody that's been requested repeatedly by listeners of the show, and we're like, look, when he's in LA, if we can make it happen, we will absolutely make it happen. And this is it, baby, finally. Welcome to the show, Don May Jr.
Thank you.
From Sin
here. Finally here.
I've been like talking to you online for it's close to 14 years now. Yeah. Since like you guys were like one of my first clients at Fangoria.
Right. And I think we've even paid for ads that we haven't seen yet.
You may never see them.
Burn.
Yeah. No, it's totally true. There's a good chance of that.
Damn.
Let's shake down Becky.
Moving
right
on. Yeah.
Been out for 2 years, gents.
Was that full page ads or quarter page
I'm
ads?
Sure they were full page. Synapse always took full page in the first 25%.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Wow.
And it really worked.
I know.
Yeah.
So I wish I could help you guys now.
You know, there's so much ground we want to cover. There's so many releases that you've done and that are coming up that we definitely want to talk about. But I feel it's only fair. I mean, for all of us, we're all movie nerds. We love movies, and we all have that moment where they became something more than just something you watch, you know, where you fall in love with film. Mm-hmm. So, I want to know what that was for you and how early it was that you kind of developed an appreciation for film and in particular horror, cult, weird kind of cinema.
I've got a great story. I don't know how long this will go.
Go.
But when I was younger, my sister was 10 years older than me. So she was like in high school and I was in grade school when The Exorcist came out. I'm turning 50 this year, so that should tell you how old I am. And The Exorcist played at the drive-in where I grew up in little town of Lincoln, Illinois. And my sister went to the drive-in with one of those old 70s tape recorders, you know, the big ones with the buttons and you have the drive-in speaker. And she recorded all those horrible noises, you know, to tease me because I was her little brother. And she come home, and my parents would work till 5. We'd get out of school around 3 o'clock, and she'd go over to her friend's house, and I'd be at my house. And she'd be like, I'm going to the neighbors, I'll be down the street at Julie's or wherever. And she'd turn on the tape recorder, and she'd leave. And I'd be in the house by myself, and I'd hear, and I'd be like, oh, Christ, I'd get all scared. What year did that come out? I must have been
77?
No,
74.
Yeah. So I was around 6 or 7 at the time. And
Ryan
and,
has the Google.
Yeah.
73.
And 73.
So I got so scared, but at that point, even at that age, I was like, why, what is this? At the time, my family was very religious. We'd go to school. I was in Sunday school. So, that whole thing. And I saw it at that, very shortly after that.
Wow.
And it scarred me for life.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, this is much worse than I imagined. I would go to Sunday school and I'd see this little Linda Blair and it's like, why is this happening to her? My God, Satan's going to come up to the floor and get me, And I slept in my parents' room for like 3 weeks and I was horrified. And that's the only movie in my entire life that has scared me that bad.
Yeah.
And it still does. I haven't watched The Exorcist I shouldn't say I haven't. I didn't watch The Exorcist all the way through from beginning to end by myself until about 4 years ago.
Wow.
And
so was it everything that you thought it would be?
Yeah. I mean, it's got everything. It still bugs me.
It's a great movie.
It still bugs me, and it's brilliant because it deals with the backwards messages and the subliminal noises and the crosses on the doors. And
Ouija board.
Which I actually have a Ouija board at my house, and I've never used it, but it's sitting in the basement. But that movie was what started me loving horror. And at that age, I thought, okay, this movie scared me. What other movies are going to scare me? And I made my father take me to everything. And he was really cool. On Friday night, we'd get the papers. We lived in a little town that was kind of in between big cities.
So where were you from?
Lincoln, Illinois. Okay. So we'd get the Bloomington paper, which was 30 miles north, and the Springfield paper, which was 30 miles south. And they'd all have movie theaters playing different things. And I'd get the Friday paper, and I'd sit it on the table, and I'd circle the movie that I wanted him to take me to see. And it was always horror. Mm-hmm. I mean, my father took me to everything.
And he was cool with it? Was he a movie star too?
Yeah. He was really cool with it. And, he took me to everything from, like, Friday the 13th to, Young Frankenstein to My Bloody Valentine, Altered States, all that stuff as I was growing up.
Do you remember when you enjoyed it, the act of enjoying it, not just being scared after Exorcist? Like, which one kind of was like, oh, I actually like this feeling?
Phantasm.
Oh, yes.
Nice.
Oh,
wow.
Great.
Yeah, because I was having a Halloween party that night and for my classmates at the time, and it was the night that it premiered on HBO. And my friend Steve Hernan, at the time, we were like brothers, and we would, go do everything together. We're like, let's ditch my own party and go into the living room and check out Phantasm while everybody's outside. And it was a blast. I mean, it was so weird,
And you must have been close to the age of the protagonist.
Yeah. I was watching this and I was like, what the? What was I? Was that 79? So I was 12, 13.
Yeah, same age.
And it came out on HBO maybe like a year later. Mm. And it was crazy. And I was like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. And that's when I knew that horror, was like my thing. I mean, I'd seen Night of the Living Dead on TV, late at night and stuff like that. But The Exorcist is the one that warped me and still does. I still have problems watching it, to this day.
Have you watched the show at all? The most recent show?
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, I think it's great.
I absolutely loved it, and I hope they renew it.
They have.
They did.
Thank God.
Thank God.
Just announced.
Because it's great.
Yeah.
Now, we've also had debates on the site about part three being scarier than the original, which is what some contemporaries
It's not, but it's a great film.
Okay. Yes. But
one,
still
three,
think,
the show.
Yeah.
That's all we need.
Yeah. Yeah. No, three is awesome.
Are you not a Heretic fan, Galooza?
No, not at all.
Oh, come on. The Heretic has its charms. That weird, the Blu-ray of the Heretic is weird because, you know, Linda Blair is very young, and there's that scene where she's walking in her gown on the roof of the building, and it's like, ew, in high def, you can kind of see through it. That's creepy.
Come on, John Borman, what do you think?
I've yet to crack that open.
Yeah. No, I haven't done that either. I've only seen it on TV once.
Yeah. It deserves a rewatch. Yeah.
Well, one is scary from start to finish because of the atmosphere, whereas three has a couple of the best shock scares.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's more of a detective film, you know. Yeah. But it's a really entertaining
movie. And so that's mine. The Exorcist is the one that really fucked me up and made me a horror fan.
And what was the film that pushed you into wanting to be part of the business and be part of the horror
Night of the Living Dead. And that happened kind of as a fluke.
Yeah.
You know, I graduated from Illinois State. I always wanted to be in the film business, but in Illinois, you grow up, you're like, what the, you know, nobody is in the film business. You know, in Illinois, you got to be either in New York or LA. But I thought, well, if I go to college and I study broadcasting, maybe something will happen. So I went to Illinois State. They had a great broadcasting program and I studied photography. And I graduated and nothing was around except for weatherman, you know, jobs. Like I could be a newscaster or something. And I was like, oh, crap. So I was one of those guys that graduated from college. I was still living in the basement of a fraternity after college, trying to figure out my way. Mm-hmm. And I worked at a laser disc store because I loved laser discs, you know. And I was like, I became the buyer of a laser disc of the store Laser's Edge in Bloomington, Illinois.
You had a whole laser disc store?
Yes.
That is so badass.
It was like Ken's out here, you know, and all that.
Wow. We had to get ours from Zayer.
Yeah. Well, you know, so we had this store and I was the buyer. And one of my distributors and I were, my rep at the time, was talking to me on the phone. He's like, when Night of the Living Dead came out on Laserdisc from like Republic Pictures or something, and it had a fucking picture of Dawn of the Dead on it. You know, like the guy with the machete in his head. And it was in the collage of images they put on the front of the disc. And it's like, it's the wrong movie. These idiots don't know what they're doing. And it looked terrible. And I said, man, and here I am, you know, out of college, kind of trying to find my way. And I said, wouldn't it be great if we could just do this? And he goes, yeah, it would be great, you know. And then I was having a real shitty week, well, like a month later. And I was like, we got to do this thing. The Zombie Jamboree, which was the anniversary Night of the Living Dead convention that they had in Pittsburgh. I said, let's go to this thing and just see what we can do. Not even thinking that it was actually going to happen. It was just like something like, okay, I'm in my 20s. I want to talk to George Romero. Let's just see if we can, you know, say, hey, man, we want to do Night of the Living Dead. And we thought for sure he'd be like, yeah, right, whatever. You know, go away, kid. You bother me, you know. And we're at the convention and we meet, you know, George, and we pose the question, hey, can we do a real version of Night of the Living Dead? And keep in mind, I had no idea how to even do a laser disc. You know, I was like, I don't know what to do, but let's just see if something happens. And George was like, yeah, sure. We got 10 shareholders. Give us $10,000 so I can pay each one of these guys $1,000 and we're done. And we'll give you access to everything that we have.
If only all of them were that easy.
And I kind of was like, okay, what? Excuse me? You know, and at that point, we were like, okay, I guess we better figure out how to do a laser disc.
Yeah.
You know, and if the people remember, it took us like a year to do it because we didn't know what we were doing. Hmm. You know, George put his trust in us and we had to learn fast how to do this thing, and went and they gave us access to the negative. And I was like holding the original negative for Night of the Living Dead in my hands. I was like, this is crazy. But all along we thought, okay, we're going to do this thing. It's going to be a neat thing that we're going to do for George and Carl and Marilyn and all these guys. And then we're just going to end up going back to our crappy jobs. But after we put out Night of the Living Dead on Laserdisc, I think we sold something I don't even remember what it was. I mean, it was thousands of pieces, and it was like a $99 item. Yeah. And we're like, holy shit, this is actually happening. Yeah. Yeah. And then we won awards. TV Guide awarded us Laserdisc of the Year over Snow White.
Wow.
And that was it. And then suddenly Elite Entertainment was born, and we were like, okay. And I moved to New Jersey with, you know, zero money in my pocket, just like, okay. And we started getting phone calls, people like, hey, you want to do this? Hey, you want to do that? And then Jay Douglas, that worked at Anchor Bay, called us up and said, hey, we really liked what you did with Night of the Living Dead. What if we worked a deal with you where you could do the laser discs of some of our titles, and you do the mastering, and you give us the masters so we can put out our VHS? Because at the time, VHS was huge, and Laserdisc was so niche, it wasn't even worth it. So we ended up getting movies like Nightmare on Elm Street 1, 2, and 3, and Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead, and Evil Dead, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Chainsaw 2. And it was suddenly it was a business that I never in my life dreamed that we would be doing. And here I am, 25 years later, still doing it.
I remember I was going to say, I just remember those laser discs coming out. Those were like, that's what I worked my ass off at Stop and Shop for. Yeah. Those fucking laser discs. Those were the precursor to these multi discs come out and everybody freaks out. I remember like Nightmare on Elm Street was literally a film school laser disc. There were a couple laser discs that felt like film school to me. And it was Night of the Living Dead, Nightmare on Elm Street, and then the Criterion, Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah.
And I just poured over every single detail. Mm-hmm.
So was Night of the Living Dead technically the Laserdisc? Was that the first Elite release?
Yes.
Elite Entertainment?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
And you guys did that whole thing where it started with the kind of
the crappy
version.
Yeah, and then it blows up and blows turns it. Yeah.
That's cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
It wasn't – was one of the special features Night of Living Bread on there?
Yeah.
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 So funny.
Now, do you still have laser discs?
I do. Okay. I still have all the ones that I produced, and I still have a whole shit ton of them in my basement that I won't sell. There's stuff that's on laser discs that's still not out.
Wow.
You know, like the uncut version of Milo and Otis.
I didn't know there was an uncut version.
Yeah. Does it get risque?
You Google it. It's really,
is that where they show all the dogs dying?
Yes.
Or, Yeah.
Wow.
Did you get out of that before that market went belly up, or how far?
Well, what happened, I mean, out of respect for my previous business partner, I won't really go into what happened, but I left right at the beginning of DVD. I mean, I was working on – we put out Night of the Living Dead on DVD, and I left – it was like 4 years after I had started Elite. I moved on and joined with my one of my friends who I met on the pages of Fangoria magazine in the free subscriber ads, Jerry Chandler.
Oh, you guys met in Fangoria?
Yes.
That's amazing. Love Jerry.
Remember the little free subscriber ads back in the Count Fangor days?
I remember when we did away with the free subscriber ads.
But it was, you know, hey, you know, it had like his address, and it's like, your list gets mine, Video Trader.
Yes, that's
and
so cool.
I used to get every single one of those lists, and that's where I saw so much stuff was getting it from those Fango ads, where it'd be like, you know, weird international stuff, swap VHS, and that's how I ended up seeing all the guinea pig films.
Right,
and, like people sending me videotapes, unlabeled, weird shit. Well, okay.
What happened was I saw this, and it was, you know, and I was like, yeah, I don't really like this video trading stuff because I was always like kind of freaked out by it. You know, I was young. I was like 13, 14 years old, and I was just like in eighth grade, and I see this ad, and it's Jerry put his ad in there, your list gets mine. And I send him the ad, and my nickname in school was Pete. It wasn't Don. And it was just based on, you know, my dad's name was Pete. And then when I was, you know, his nickname was Pete. And then when I was born, it was Repeat. So I put on the paper, hey, here's my address or my list, signed P. You know, I didn't even put my full name. And it was funny. We have an office in Detroit now. He's still got my letter. He keeps it in the office. and it's like he I remember he didn't know my name. So he called my house and he's like, "Is P there?" You know, and it started this relationship. I've known Jerry since I was 14, and then once the Holy Elite thing ended, we started Synapse, and he became my business partner sort of inadvertently. Because we were such good friends, and I mean, he's my best friend, you know, in the world. He said, "Okay, you want to do your own thing, you know, I'll just give you a few bucks, you know, and then you can pay me back like a normal business, like an interest rate, you know, whatever." And he offered some money to get my company going. And when I gave him the paperwork from the lawyer, I gave him like part, you know, equal shares of the company. And I said, no, I'm not going to give you, you know, your money back. You're going to stay with me and you're going to run this business with me and we're going to grow it together.
And was his background business?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
How did you guys end up in Detroit? From Illinois to Jersey?
Well, I, you know, growing up in Illinois, when we started Elite, I went to Jersey. And then 4 years later, I moved back to Illinois to try to get, you know, something going again. And then we ran Synapse from Illinois for the first few years. We were distributed by Image Entertainment mm-hmm. at the time. And
I remember when you guys moved.
Yeah. And then I moved from from Illinois to Michigan to be closer to Jerry so that we could work together.
Oh.
And it's been great ever since, wow. You know, this last year was our 20th year together.
Oh, wow. My gosh.
You know, and when you figure I was with Elite for 4 years and now it's five times that with Synapse, it's crazy.
So what was the first title that Synapse did?
We did two titles, but the one that was 002, I think, came out first. I think it was either Dario Argento's World of Horror.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was like some other, and Document of the Dead.
Nice.
And yeah.
That's Roy Frumkin.
Yeah.
Former screenwriting teacher.
Because you also have Street Trash.
Right. And so those were the first two. And I was like, I leave Elite Entertainment and we put out documentaries. But it was huge.
Oh.
And you know, can you talk a little bit about, I'm always curious about, I love the format changes. And mm-hmm. I remember getting in really early. Like, I couldn't afford Laserdisc. I was collecting VHS, and then they did widescreen VHS. And then I started buying DVDs before I had a DVD player.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone made fun of me, but I was like, but when I get my player, I'm already going to have the collection.
Right.
So when Synapse formed, that was the beginning of DVD,
yes, exactly, yeah.
So do you remember that transition, and did it just seem like ideal, like, all right, if we're going to do Synapse, it has to be DVD forward,
right. Well,
not Laserdisc
anymore. We did a few Laserdiscs.
We did.
We did a Document and World of Horror and Gamera Laserdisc. And they were like gold colored, you know, and all this other stuff. But then DVD was just like, okay, this is the way to go. We started getting calls like, okay, this replication plant's closing. You can't do Laserdisc anymore.
Wow.
And I keep hoping, like vinyl, that someone will like, hey, I've got a Laserdisc plant that I'm opening. And, you know.
The Laserdisc like resurge.
I would love that. I would so do like. You know, laser discs of some of our stuff.
Now, do you still collect laser discs?
I have been guilty of buying a few that I've seen used. Yeah.
There's a place offhand. In Burbank called American Way Thrift that I swear is a laser disc gold.
You know what I found here in town in I guess you guys have a Koreatown.
Yes.
I went to a laser like a thrift shop in Koreatown, and they had like old crappy laser discs, and they had the Japanese laser disc of Sweet Home. Which has never come out.
Wow.
And they had the uncut version of Raimi's Quick and the Dead on Laserdisc.
Oh,
I remember that.
Yeah. Wow. And I was like, okay, I'll take these. And Sweet Home is still a movie that will probably never get released on DVD or Blu-ray. And
that one I've always been looking for. It's only VHS.
Yeah.
I still never seen
and
it.
And they have, I was like, oh my God, I think and I paid like $15 for it. You know, they were like, oh, Laserdisc, who cares? You know, so yeah.
What's the quality comparison between Laserdisc now and say a brand new Blu-ray to you? What are the
I can't watch
comparison?
Them anymore.
Yeah,
I mean, we still do DVDs.
Yeah,
Because there's still
a lot of
market.
People when they have
sure. And but I can't watch them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so weird because the VHS era, everybody watched stuff, you know, you'd have four movies, 90 minute movies on an EP tape and it's like, hey, this is great.
Yeah.
You know, and you take them to your friend's house and you put them on and you drink and watch stupid movies all night long on one tape. And it was perfectly fine. And then Laserdisc came along and it's like, wow, this is awesome. Look at the quality. And now you look at Laserdisc and you're like, oh, Jesus Christ. What was, you know, the quality is so different.
I have a tough time watching DVD now because I'm so used to my setup and Blu-ray. And it just I was saying before when you came on, like every title that I grew up watching looks better than it's like has any right to look.
Right.
And I can't unsee it now. It's it's amazing.
Yeah, VHS is – and I hate to say it because I'm such like a – I love – VHS and I love finding the films that are still stuck on VHS. But now when I go back and I'm like, I'm going to watch Blood Damage or whatever. It hurts.
Yeah.
To watch some of these
it's
films.
It's like laying in bed and just putting something on and then falling asleep. Yeah. You just know it's going to play itself out. Like My Demon Lover, for instance.
I watched My Demon
Lover last night.
Right. But there's still stuff on VHS like Amazing Colossal Man and Invasion of the you know, you can't get those.
Yeah, we talk a lot about the horror films that are still stuck on VHS. Like Elric and I are big fans of the Lovecraft anthology.
Sure.
Jeff Combs is in. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you go back and try to watch it on
VHS.
Things
that just fall through the gap.
Cthulhu Mansion, love. Yeah. It's just a gem.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
but yeah.
It's crazy that, you know, there's so much stuff out there. And that's why, you know, people ask me all the time. They're like, well, you're doing this and you're doing this and, you know, what, you know, there's so many companies that are doing, you know, the same thing. And like, there's plenty of movies out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tons.
You know, and remember like 10 years ago when there were like 30 of us, mm-hmm. 30, I mean, you had, you know, people like Barrel and, you know, all these other companies doing the same thing. And, you know, they're all gone. There's only a handful of us left.
What about the – I know one thing I think that maybe set some of your titles, especially recently, apart is the archivist preservation side of making the most glorious looking image you can possibly get on the screen.
Right.
Where did that come from and how did you learn that side of the business?
I'm OCD.
Uh-huh. Okay, that would help.
And because I did Night of the Living Dead the way we did it and because I did, you know, all that, it sort of rubbed off on me. And – I can't let things go sometimes. And that's like, I mean, I'll tell you, you know, like Suspiria, which is one of the reasons why I'm in town. You know, a normal movie back when we were doing Laserdisc, we'd do 20, 30 hours of color correction, you know. I think Suspiria were at like 140.
Wow.
And it's, I have never done that much color correction in my life on any title.
Wow.
I think, you know, and it's like when you're paying hundreds of dollars an hour just for the, and it's like, oh my God, we're at like 100 plus hours on this movie already and we're still not done.
And how do you have a reference point to what you're trying to color correct to? Because I know you work with the cinematographer.
Yeah. That's the thing with Suspiria. Of course, you get film materials from Fox or, you know, like we got material from the BFI. Yeah. And, you know, there's so many video releases like Blue Undergrounds. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, The Wild Side, which came out in 2007. And so we took all those and we watched them and we analyzed them and we took notes. And then we ended up getting last year, we got an IB Technicolor projection to look at the color. And then we got another one from the BFI just recently. We watched on Friday. And taking those, all those things into consideration, it's like, well, is, you know, how gold is this? How gold, you know, is this too dark? Is this too light? And the thing that we're doing, and, you know, we'll reveal here, is we are working with Luciano Tavoli, the original cinematographer, which is the ultimate reference for Suspiria. You know, and that's like there's no little sound effect like da 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 da. You know, but
we might be able to add that.
We could add that.
We have.
Is he actually like walking you guys through the color grading?
Yes. Here, right now, he's busy working on a movie. So what we're doing is we're sending him. Well, over the past 2 months, we've been sending him sections and frames and questions, and we'll say, okay, frame one. You know how this is the, you know, through most of the big scenes, and we'll say, what do we do here? And he'll say, take the magenta out or make this darker, make this lighter. And, you know, he's been working with us every step of the way. And we are going to get his ultimate sign off. You know, there are other companies that are touting restorations and they're doing their own thing and they're patting themselves on the back of how great they are. But if you don't ask the guy who created the imagery, what's the point? You know, for a film like Suspiria, and no offense to like something like Mountaintop Motel Massacre, but this isn't Mountaintop Motel Massacre. This is Suspiria, and it's known for the color.
Its aesthetics is the movie, right? It's like,
so to do a restoration on Suspiria without the participation of the DP is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not, I mean, it completely negates, you know, the whole, you know, the, you could spend 2 years on Suspiria, but if you don't get the sign off on the guy who made it, why bother?
Yeah. In a case like that, isn't it easy courting process, just approaching him and getting him on board? I mean,
I emailed him and he's like, sure.
Well, that's your legacy. That's
he was probably excited to be asked.
He was, and I get emails from him every day.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Every day. As a matter of fact, he emailed me this morning and he's like, I'm going to Amsterdam to do a talk on The Passenger because he shot The Passenger. And he goes, and I think this is the same theater and the same audience that saw that abortion of a Suspiria 4K that came out in Italy. And I'm going to tell them that what they've been seeing is a lie.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
You know, and it's like, okay, dude, I'm just waiting for that.
What?
You know?
Oh, sorry. I just want to ask one thing about color. What's the biggest – yeah, because I had this experience with that film Possession on the show. I grew up watching it, and it was very blue, and that was what the movie was in my head. It was like a blue aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And then they did the big restoration with the DP, and everyone signed off.
Right.
And it was I couldn't even believe how warm it was, and it blew my mind. Is there a misnomer that's been – that is going to be corrected with this version of Suspiria?
Right. Well, the great Robert Harris has been a friend of mine since Night of the Living Dead, and if people don't know who Robert Harris is, he did the restorations on The Godfather. He did Lawrence of Arabia. Mm. You know, he's My Fair Lady.
Yeah, very
and
colorful,
he
yeah.
is a guy that I look up to this guy. So when I have questions or if I ask for advice, and his advice is always revert to the DP. Mm. Always. Mm. And he said, I'll give you a story. When he was working on The Godfather, he was working with, you know, the DP.
Gordon Willis.
Yeah. And he was working with Francis. And Francis point blank said, listen, you got any technical issues, you talk to me. But for color, you talk to him because it's his design.
Yeah.
And that's what you should do. Now, it's not to say that, you know, like, he even said that, like, even on Lawrence of Arabia, you know, they looked at it, they got it the way it originally was, and then they had some slight changes made. You know, people's opinions and things change. So, but Tivoli's, it's funny because he is dead on with his, he's like, this is supposed to be this way. This is supposed to be this way. Mm-hmm. And when I say, well, you know, this other version has it, this other color. He's like, no. It's this way.
Wow.
You know? So he knows exactly what he wants, and he's very detailed in his explanation. One of the things that opened my eyes about Suspiria that I wouldn't even have thought of is he said, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he said, when I did Suspiria, it wasn't about the play between light and dark or, you know, light and shadow, which is traditionally a horror film, is light and shadow and, you know, things that go bump in the dark and, you know, that kind of thing. He said everything is mostly very well lit in Suspiria, and it always was supposed to be. My design was conflict between color, not conflict between light and dark.
The fairy tale element that comes
through. Right. And so I was just like, whoa, you know, because there are scenes in Suspiria that are dark, you know, when like Stefania Cassini is walking in the attic and she goes right. around that corner
blue
and there's
light.
And there's that guy in that black outfit mm-hmm. standing there with his eyes showing. And of course, on the negative, you can see the guy, the poor guy standing in the corner with his outfit on, hoping that, you know, you time it down enough so you can't see the poor guy standing there. But that's yeah. there's stuff like that. But he said, no, everything's lit and should be fairly bright. It's just the conflict in this movie for me is the primary colors, you know, fighting each other.
So the people who are sitting around complaining, going, oh, where's Suspiria? It's because you guys are going to give the best possible version
right,
of Suspiria.
Right, yeah. I mean, these things take time. And yeah. one of the other things that our Suspiria has that no one has used, in 77, they made prints with magnetic LCR, what they call LCRS four-channel sound. Mm-hmm. In other words, when you go to a movie theater, you know, you have optical sound on the print and it plays through. Well, not today, but, right, you know, yeah, now they yeah. have digital. But back in those days, it was just read off of an optical reader and it played the sound. Well, Suspiria, certain prints had mag tracks on them. They'd have two mag stripes on the left of the frame and two on the right. And each one of those was like left, center, right, and a mono surround. And it was discrete surround. So it wasn't like Dolby where you get a stereo and then certain frequencies would just throw to the back. Suspiria was specifically mixed with directional dialogue. You know, nowadays you get a 5.1 and all the dialogue's in the center. Yeah. In Suspiria, there's people fucking talking as they walk behind and, you know, you hear things, you know, people way over to the left and people way over to the right. There's one really funny scene in Suspiria where there's like girls talking in a room and there's one girl sitting in the center of the frame with a pair of scissors. And the only thing in the center channel at that moment is her scissors noise, you know? So they really did this That's crazy yeah. surround wow. track and we're going to be the first people to present it that wow. way.
That's amazing.
On home video. And it's cool. it's really crazy. And, you know, that's what, you know, what we have over, you know, everyone else. And the problem with Suspiria, when we first got it, we were all excited, you know, hey, my God, you know, and again, it fell into our lap with a phone call. We were just calling a sales rep and we're like, hey, you know, what you got? And they go, well, Miramax let the option drop on Suspiria. I guess they're not making the remake anymore. Now somebody else is doing it, yeah. I guess. Yeah. But they go, yeah, they let their option go. So it's back. And we're like, I looked at Jerry across the room and I'm like, dude, what? And he just goes, we'll take it. Yeah. And, you know, and it was like, he didn't even ask how much.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, we'll take it. We'll deal with it. You know, whatever it is, we want this. And we ended up getting the title just because of like a fluke phone call. But the licensor, all the material for Suspiria was in Italy, and Technicolor Rome was getting ready to close permanently, and that's where the material was. So it was a lot. We announced it. We're like, hey, we're doing Suspiria, and then all the trouble started. It's like, well, how do we get it? They won't ship it to us, so you have to scan it in Italy, and they're closing on December 31st. This lab is closing forever.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, yeah, we'll do it. And then we'd never hear from them. And I'm like, what's happening? You know, it was like a really horrible thing. And then we get the masters. It's 12 terabytes of data spread over like 12 tapes, you know, and like four of them didn't work. Mm-hmm. And so we had months of time going through it. And then we get it and there's no opening and closing credits.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, well, where's the Italian credits? And they're like, I don't know. You know, we didn't have them. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't have them? Well, if they didn't scan them, then we didn't have them. And, well, where's the 4-channel? Well, we don't have that either. What do you have? Well, we have this 5.1. It's like, well, that 5.1 isn't the real sound. It's like some mix of some horrible thing that you've probably done. And, you know, so we spent a lot of time researching. We finally got the Italian credit negative for the beginning and the end of the film. We finally found the 4-channel surround, And, you know, it's just been a task. And then dealing with the damage, the negative was in terrible shape. I mean, there were frames missing. There were scratches. There were splices. And I was just like, this is Suspiria. Why does it look so bad?
We have heard stories from Murawski before about how poorly the Italians looked after these beautiful prints. Like The Beyond, he told us crazy stories about that.
I mean, and I'm not even joking when I tell you this, there were purple, greasy fingerprints at almost every splice on one of the reels. And like, couldn't you use gloves when you were, you know? I mean, I was actually making a joke. It's like, we should scan this frame, get the fingerprint, and send it to the FBI and see who the hell this is that like ruined this movie. And funny. So we spent well over 12 months with this company in Poland cleaning Suspiria. We got bids all over town here, and I was like, well, that'll cost you about $150,000. What? Excuse me, $150,000 to clean this thing? And you know, we had to bid, we had to find, and we found a company that was willing to do it because they wanted to prove to me that they could, and they want to work. You know, they want to use it as a springboard for their business. Like, hey, we did Suspiria, and they did a fantastic job. At least so far, you know, I've been looking and we've been, you know, checking things out. It's very clean. But there was Suspiria. I got it scanned and I was all excited to look at it, and I felt crushed because I was like, who would let the negative of this movie get so terrible? And
that's why what you're doing is so important.
Because you're
saving a movie.
Well,
for
people,
generation.
You know, the fans, they don't understand. They're just like, where is it? Where is it? Why is it taking so long? You know, it shouldn't take. I got an email the other day, I'm not even kidding, from somebody who's like, I know that it shouldn't take this long to do Suspiria. It's like, oh, you do?
Yeah.
Really?
It's because everything's available. You know?
Does that serve as a lesson for future larger titles? Just keep it on the down low? Or do you gain something from giving advance notice?
Well, I left the internet pretty much 2 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I
miss your Facebook rants.
I got tired of the bullshit. Yeah. I got tired, you know, it's just, you know, you put yourself out there and then everyone expects you to answer their questions. And it's like, if I answered everybody's question, I would never get any work done.
That's why podcasts are good. You're talking one way.
And people ask me, like, why did you leave? You know, why I miss you. You know, I'm on Instagram if people want to go over there. But I left Twitter. I left Facebook because in the morning when I'd get up, you know, and I work, you know, from like 7 to 7, you know, I get up, I'd get my coffee, I'd sit down, I'd load Facebook, and all I would see is bitching, you know, and it's like, I don't need to see everyone else's problems. I got plenty of my own.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to email me, you can email me with a question, you know, but you'd say something like, wow, what a beautiful day. You know, I'm going to go sit out on the porch and enjoy the sunshine. Then somebody'd say, fuck you, my dog died, you asshole. How inconsiderate.
Sunshine sucks.
how inconsiderate of you.
How dare you enjoy the morning.
Right.
My watch.
We're pretty lucky to have good listeners, actually, when you say it like that.
So I'm like, okay, fuck this. Yeah. I'm leaving. I'm tired of this. Oh. So, you know, and then that kind of raised the ire of the forum posters because they're like, well, Don's not here to answer his these questions. And then they, you know, but, you know, we have a business to run. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, we love the fans that are really cool. We have, you know, thousands of fans that, you know, email us and appreciate everything we do. And then we have the 9 or 10 that are like, fuck him.
Well,
he's not answering my questions.
Yeah, but you're also bringing other titles. I mean, I was going to ask you what other title was the hardest one besides Suspiria, but I imagine like just bringing up Popcorn because Rob also.
Well, Popcorn was another one that we had forever.
Was that like a rights thing that was holding it up?
Well, Popcorn is, you know, and another one that people are like, where's Popcorn? Where's Popcorn? And I was like, oh, you know. I'm going to take the blame because I just want to make sure it's as good as I can possibly make it. You know, I'm not going to shit something out because, oh, we've only got this movie for 5 years. We got to get this out on the market and get the maximum amount of profit, you know, so put it out.
Well, these could be the last. I mean, this might be the last physical format of these movies. So it feels like you might as well give it everything.
Yeah. I could have put out a version of Popcorn from a print with optical sound, mm-hmm. and I'm sure the fans would have been happy, but I wouldn't have been.
Yeah.
So we dealt with one of the producers. And he goes, "Hey, I got all this popcorn shit in my garage. You want to see it?" Sure. And then we end up getting like this car-sized pallet of shit delivered to our office. Like, wait, you just sent us everything. And a couple of the things, and I wonder, because I haven't heard from anybody, but I wonder if any sharp-eyed viewers of Popcorn have noticed that ours is different than the one that came out on home video in that our version represents – an earlier IP before they actually sold it. So the credits at the beginning are different.
Oh.
Really?
Crazy.
Yeah.
Tidbit.
Yeah. But so he gave us like the earliest possible generation interpositive. And I was like, oh, and it was the best quality one. So I said, oh, that's great. But all he had was the optical negative sound. So it's hissy. People who don't understand what that is, it's like the audio is like on a record, it's got the pops and the ticks and the sound is being played through, a machine that's not a tape. And I was bummed. I was like, well, this optical sound, it's stereo. It's going to sound like crap, but we can do some, cleanup. And then I realized that Sony had put it out years ago on tape. So I call Sony and I'm like, hey, do you guys have anything for this movie? And they're like, yeah, but we have the mags, which is the ultimate, for mixing. We were able to do a 7:1 because they had separated dialogue, music, and effects on mag, really good quality. But yeah, we'll get that in legal sometime in the next decade for you to figure it out. We got better things to do than your crappy movie, that you want. And so it took a year to get anything out of Sony to use for the audio. But I waited a year just because I wanted the best audio that we could get. And you know what? Some of the fans understand that and they appreciate it, I mean, I'm not like a business that, we don't have a lot of employees. We don't have a lot of overhead. And a lot of companies, like Shout Factory, and Jeff and those guys over there, they get a title. They got to get that thing out because they got, a building. They've got 30, 40 employees. Yeah. They've got a bottom line. They've got upper management going, hey, when is this coming? We bought this last year. It's just me and Jerry, And Jerry yells at me all the time. He's like, when are we going to put this fucking thing out? Thundercrack's taking us 7 fucking years. When are we going to do this thing? So
the fact that someone is doing a deliberately meticulous job of Thundercrack.
Right.
Have you guys seen Thundercrack?
No,
it's the most artistic yet sleazy comedy porn.
Right.
It's just weird.
Yeah.
That's
another story. We kept finding more and more footage. As we went along, we'd edit, we'd get it locked.
You mean I have not seen the full
Thundercrack? Well, we've seen about as much as we could possibly find. But the funny thing about Thundercrack was, it's like we lock it. We're like, okay, we're done. And then we send it to Melinda, who was one of the stars and the sister of the guy who directed the film. And then we'd realize, wait, there's like a 10-second shot of somebody saying hello that's not in ours. Where is that? And it's like, but it was in there and it's in the script and I know we shot it, so we got to find it. And it was just like, ugh. And we finally got it, finally did it. But yeah, that's the reason why a lot of Synapse Films titles take a lot longer than usual.
Now, do you put the same type of care in some of the international ones that you bring over? Like you guys did the whole Nikkatsu collection.
Right. Now the Nikkatsus, we do high def masters of some of them, like Fairy in a Cage, which they have materials for, but most of them have come from Nikkatsu has masters and like, look, we don't know where the material is for this, so this is the master that we get, and it's disappointing sometimes, but We put them out on DVD.
Is it just as degraded as – I'm always curious how cultures respect their more of exploitation films. Yeah. So, like the Pinky films, did Japan respect these enough to keep them
You know, it's preserved? Funny. They're masters, even though they're standard def anamorphic, digital beta cams most of the time. They still look good. You know, we haven't had any real issues with any of the Nakatsu stuff. It's just they don't really know where a lot of the material is. You know, it's like I would have loved to have gotten a new master, to do a high def of White Rose Campus, which is like the most offensive thing ever.
There was one about a boy who I think was supposed to be a farmer and a pig.
Stop right there.
That one I was a little like, oh my.
Well, did you see the one about the rapist that goes back to high school?
Oh, I think Jesus. That was this one. Did he have a pig in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that was this one.
And then
one.
The guy can't get laid, so he has sex with the pig instead.
That's the one. So that was the I'd seen a couple of the Nakatsu ones, I watched that one, and then I was like, these films are not made for me.
Well, the greatest
they're made for me.
I appreciate them, but these are not made for me.
The greatest thing in that whole movie is the after the pig has gets screwed by the guy, the other girl loses her virginity and bleeds out on the sidewalk, and the pig comes over and starts licking the blood.
Good Lord.
Visual picture in my head.
I did not make it that far. Oh, my. Nakatsu, ladies and gentlemen.
Becca's going home and checking it out.
Yeah,
that's
good.
One of your best sellers, huh?
Yeah.
It actually is my favorite one of all the ones that we've done because it's so fucking
just
offensive.
So crazy.
It is so – well, we're going to be doing White Rose Campus, which is probably the most offensive movie in Nakatsu, I would imagine. I mean, it's White Rose Campus, Then Everyone Got Raped is the actual title of the movie.
Yeah, these Nakatsu movies.
All right, we're in Blumhouse. I'm just going to pitch it.
We will not be remaking that.
Remake. Yeah. It's basically a bunch of schoolgirls on a bus that get pulled over by a bunch of guys that take them back to their place and rape them for 70 minutes. Oh.
These films and the Nakatsu ones, I'm fascinated more by the history. Like, I cannot make it through the films, but the history behind them, because they did really well in Japan during the time.
They absolutely did.
And it all fell under this
Ryan's
kind
eyes
of...
right now.
Yeah. I know.
Bulging.
And they were really successful, and it all kind of fell under this, Pinky realm.
Right.
And, it's a fascinating history to go look
why.
At the exploitation in Japan, but I can't watch them.
You know, the title escapes me but we did one. I mean, they have some really good ones that are, horror-based, too. There was one that we did with it was a giallo, but it was made in Japan, and it was this black gloved killer is mutilating these women and burning their vaginas and hanging them on jungle gyms. And it's the craziest giallo.
Huh.
I was in Japan. And of course, now that I'm here, I can't remember the damn name.
One of our listeners will tell us.
Of course.
I'm sure.
But it's they watched Dario Argento and they made this crazy sex horror film.
My God.
You know, but the Nakatsu.
I believe it's Zoom In Sex Apartments.
That's.
He found it.
But you guys have also, I remember there was.
You will be ordering it.
There was a really fascinating one that you guys released out of France that was, I can't even remember the name of it, but it was about these underground creatures. Why am I? It was low budget, but it was really good.
Oh, Resonances.
Resonances.
Yeah,
I liked that one.
I love those. You know, that's the other thing. I mean, for any of you people that are listening that you may have made a little movie and you're like, I'm not going to send this to anybody. Send them to us and let us look at them, because this kid made Resonances for zero money.
Yeah.
And it was so cool. I mean, obviously low budget. Obviously, these guys were had a freaking video toaster or something.
I gotta see it. I haven't heard of that one.
It was quite fascinating. And, I mean, it feels low budget, but it's charming.
It's got computer effects, but they're really ambitious and really
a creature
fun.
Feature.
Yeah. And you know, we get these people that send us, movies. And
Becca talked about that years ago, I remember.
Resonances?
Yeah. It was really fun. And I hope the guy who made it gets other work. Mm-hmm. You know, we've actually done, Adam Wingard.
I just had to bring that up.
Yeah.
His first film,
We did Homesick. I mean, he came to us hat in hand, this kid who had zero money. And he's like, look, I'm a big fan. And my movie Homesick is stuck on a hard drive on a broken Amiga video toaster. And we don't have any money to finish it, and we can't edit it, and I can't get the files off of it. Can you guys help us?
Oh, wow.
And it's so crazy that Adam has gone on to do what he's done since Homesick.
I hope he returns your calls still.
Oh, yes. He does. He does. Yeah, he does. Just making sure. Well, I hit him up. Last time I was in town, I hit him up because I wanted to see Blair Witch, but he was like, I'm in Canada shooting Death Note. I'm not home.
Wow.
Otherwise, I would have. But yeah, I mean, a lot of these, you know, like Adam, you know, we ended up doing his first, and it's really fun. I mean, a lot, you know, Homesick.
Bill Moseley's in it.
Yeah. You know, Homesick's a great little movie. I mean, we saw it, you know, after we were able to pull the files off of the Amiga video toaster and figure out what this movie was, you know, Adam came and you know, we edited it together and we changed some things. And, you know, it was a really fun movie. I mean, Tiffany, you know.
Yeah, Tiffany Shepis. Yeah, I love Tiffany.
And it's a lot of fun. So, you know, being in this business, you know, it's fun to see these guys, you know, come to us as young kids, and then, you know, years later, this guy is doing stuff like Blair Witch.
Well, yeah, that's crazy. You really are part of the industry. You're not just making movies. At that point, you are part of the industry in the sense of career build, helping that development of a career,
right,
which is pretty cool.
And it's cool. Like for me, that's kind of, I mean, besides the fact that I get to work on stuff like Suspiria and, you know, that's the kind of thing that's cool. It's like, in 10 years, where is this guy going to be? You know, he sends us a VHS or something of a movie, and we watch it, and we're like, yeah, let's give this a chance. And then we realize that this guy's talented. He's got some real talent, and he ended up using it, you know?
Are there things from your library, like Homesick, things that have come out on DVD that you guys are planning on upgrading to Blu-ray?
Well, we hope to someday do Lamora. I mean, I mean, we're working on doing it right now.
That movie, and it's so dark at times. Yeah. I would really love to see it.
Well,
kinda.
It's interesting because we're scanning in high def, and it looks phenomenal in high def. It's like, oh my God.
The scene, you know, where she's with the children for the first time, and it's that she's trying to get them all to go to sleep, and it's all shot in candlelight. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. But then you go to the next scene where they're outside, and it's just like pitch black with mild amounts of movement.
Right.
Or at least that is the copy I have.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's blue and black. You know, it's like, it's this weird and, you know, weird sort of low budget thing that has all this crazy production value just because it's lit so well.
Yeah.
You do a lot of art horror too. Like, I mean, I just bought the most recent thing I bought was the Coffin Joe trilogy. Because I love the first, but I haven't seen the second.
There's another set that took forever. There's another set that took
forever. But that's not Blu-ray, right?
You know what happened with that, and we've been asked this, so I'll say, when Fantoma did the original DVDs way back when, you know, the licenses expired, and we still were talking to those guys, even though Fantoma's not really doing anything in this industry anymore. They actually told me, they said, you licensed those Coffin Joes? And we're like, yeah. And he goes, well, you do realize that when we were actually doing those in Brazil, we were scanning them. At the time, there wasn't really no need for high def. They were just doing DVD, so they did it in standard def. They were falling apart.
Ugh.
The negatives were like just, you know, just like breaking and shredding. And it's like, well, you'll never get another pull off of these really without doing further damage or really going in, taking everything apart and redo. And it was just, you know, we're not going to sell enough to do that.
Yeah.
So the Brazilian lab just gave us the scans, the high def scan or high def, the standard def scans. And we just cleaned them up and, you know, did new encodes and stuff and added those additional extras. And what was great about it was Cornell is, you know, it's Coffin Joe's son, Cornell, emailed me after they came out. And he's like, I just want you to know that me and my father really appreciate what you did.
That's awesome.
Wow.
And
so
that makes covers too.
And that makes it all worthwhile. Yeah. You know, sometimes I get up and I'm like, I don't even want to go to work today. You know,
yeah.
But there are days where something like that, or like when you know, when Tivoli, you know, says, you know, he sends me emails. He's like, you know what? You really are doing the right thing.
Well, the history of film, is you're affecting the history of film because it's how the next generation will be able to see things.
Yeah.
And if these films fall apart and never get seen, then that's now a black spot.
Yeah.
And we've lost a lot of movies along the way that we will never see saved in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Italian stuff, because that seems to be the kind of hotbed for you lately, has been, you know, from Demons 2, the Tenebrae release, which is amazing.
Yeah. Awesome.
And then now Phenomena, which is just one of my favorite Argento films anyway, just because it's so much fun.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's just such a fun movie.
Yeah.
But I mean, is that just from a passion and interest, or is it, again, like kind of an accident, the deal fell into place?
Well, it kind of, that was, you know, when the Suspiria thing happened, it was, you know, that was, we had already had Demons and Demons 2 and Tenebrae and Phenomena. And they were like, well, we're doing out Suspiria. You want that too? It's like, yeah, sure. So, you know, my thing with Demons was, you know, we got the material and it was like, it was almost like it was just a raw scan with no color, you know? So, and the previous release was that way. And I was like looking at this going, why didn't they go in and do it? Why didn't they put the color in? I mean, it's just like this drab looking thing that they put out, and they were like, well, that's the masters we received from the licensor. And I was like, yeah, but do it, you know, make it look good. And, you know, same thing with Tenebrae, you know, and Phenomena was an interesting case because we got the master for the longer version of Phenomena. And they told us that it was approved by Dario and the DP. They said, this is the way they want the movie to look. And I'd seen Phenomena a million times. And I was like, well, that's not the way I remember the movie looking. And then, and I'm like, but I'll go with it and I'll leave it the way it is out of respect for them. Because if they say that's the way they want it, that's the way I'm going to do it. So I left that version alone. But those famous weird sort of flashbacks, you know, where she's having those hallucinations and she's seeing, they didn't have that white glow to them. And I was like, well, this has to be a mistake. But they approved it. So I left it alone. Now, when we did the shorter version, the 110, the Creepers. Integral version, I went back in and I did, you know, I fixed those things and we did that. And then dealing with another reason why Phenomena came out so late is because I wanted to do Creepers in there. And that was owned by New Line, which is owned by Warner. And I had called Warner because I said, hey, can we get like a trailer or something? Because or do you have any material for Creepers? And they're like, what are you doing with Creepers? We own Creepers.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh. You know, I just opened up this horrible Pandora's box of legal bullshit.
And they tend not to, Warner Brothers is pretty much the hardest company to get stuff
from. So Warner's like, wait a minute, that's us. We got that from New Line, and we now own the New Line catalog. You can't do Creepers. And I'm like, it's like on Amazon from like a bootleg company as an Amazon video download. You know, you tell me you own this thing, but you're not enforcing your rights. And I said, are you sure? Oh, yeah, you know, we'll take it up with legal. Who did you get it from? Send us the chain of title, blah, 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 blah. And it took another, just like popcorn, it took like almost a year.
People have no idea of this stuff. This is why I love these episodes.
Yeah.
Because people have no idea.
And Warner was like, look, you know, you got to send us the chain of title, who you got it from. And then they had to pull their contracts from New Line from like the 80s, which God knows why they still have anything from that far, you know. And then the other company's like, well, no, we did a deal with New Line Cinema, but it expired in 1993. So Warner's is saying they own a movie that they don't own anymore since 1993.
Yeah, how many people have they told that to?
Right,
you know,
right.
Yeah, who just turned away because they're a big company.
And then just like that, and then we sent them that info, and then literally the next day, they're like, oh, okay, what do you need?
Oh, nice. That's great. That they
and I'm like, are you serious? You said it took me 10 months to get this.
Yeah.
And now you're just like, oh, yeah, you just roll
But
over.
They gave you everything?
Yeah.
See, that's cool.
Amazing.
And they didn't really have, they had the mag tracks and stuff for the Creepers, which is why our version of Creepers sounds amazing because they had the separated tracks. But what was funny was they sent us like this version of Creepers they had sitting in the vault. And I go, okay, I want to check this out. And we put it up, and the reels, like the leaders at the heads and the tails of all the reels, were upside down and backwards scenes from Nightmare on Elm Street 2. And I was like, they just hacked Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and put it on as leaders for their, or, you know, their vault copy.
That is officially the double feature for this week. You are going to watch Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and Phenomenal.
Well, remember, didn't they come out about the same time?
Probably, yeah. Makes sense.
You know, so it makes sense. They were probably editing both. Right. I mean, imagine that, you know, they probably got Nightmare on Elm Street 2 with Creepers footage at the heads and tails of the reels.
And I appreciate that you included Creepers, because that's the version of that movie that I first saw.
Yeah.
So I like that all your titles always have multiple versions of.
Yeah. Well, you know, Adrian Bogliano, you know, he emailed me and he's like, dude, he's like, I want to do a commentary on Creepers. It's so much better than the other two. He's like, I love Creepers. And I went, and, you know, he was doing his own thing. And, you know, we're actually producing one of his new movies.
I think I'm on the same team. I think I'm a Creepers fan. I love
Creepers.
But he loved Creepers. He's like, please let me do a commentary for that. I love that movie so much. And it's just funny. We actually reached out to Jennifer Connelly. She wouldn't have any of it. She said, nope. Mm-mm.
Wow.
Of course.
You know, I would have loved
to. Did she at least respond?
Yes, she did.
With no.
Well, what happened was Mike Gingold caught her at a screening.
Ah.
And he's like.
The gang.
Fearless Gingold.
Wait, at a Creeper screening?
No. At some movie that she was in.
A legitimate screening.
And he's like, hey, this company wants to interview you. And she's like, for Creepers? And yeah. Oh, that sounds all right. Here, and gave the info, and then all of a sudden, nothing. We're not having any of it.
You can't say no to the gang in person.
Yeah.
Right.
Gang.
You know, and that was like, well, maybe I get in touch with Paul, you know, Bellany, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I'll just let it go. You know, she's not going to want to talk about this.
Well, the one thing I really wanted to ask about is, you know, I remember when the Demons discs came out, I was working at Fearnet, and, you know, there's something about us fans where I think Lawrence Raffel, who's a big Italian horror fan, and he was my boss at Fearnet, was like, I just ordered the Steelbook edition of Demons too.
Yeah.
And as soon as he said it, I'm like, I need to do the same thing. Like, once one of your friends has something, you're like, I have to get it too.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask about, you know, that aspect, because you do release limited edition Steelbook versions for a little bit more, and then sometimes you do the single disc version later on.
Right.
What is the deal with that? Is that because you're a collector as well, or is it partly because...
It was an experiment for us. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time, you know, people do custom packaging a lot, and, you know, Criterion has their own Blu-ray package. You notice it's not like any other Blu-ray. It's like that clear, like clear thicker case. So the company that makes those for Criterion, they called us and they're like, hey, you know, you want to make a specific package design for Synapse? You've got a brand, you know, maybe you should start doing, you know, you could design your own thing the way you want. You could put a you know, make the spine as thick as you want. You could put this in there. You could do this and make it, you know, reflective, whatever you want to do. And at the time, we didn't even realize, you know, we didn't put Skinevo is like the Steelbook company. So they come down from, they're in Canada. They come down, they fly down, they meet us in Detroit, and we go out to dinner, and they pull out all the Steelbooks. I was like, you guys are the Steelbook. And yeah, we own the patent, you know, the trademark on Steelbook. That's us. We make these. And I was just like, I looked at Jerry, and I was like, we should just try it and see what happens. And, you know, there's like a fan base. You know, the Steelbooks have like their own forums. Yeah. They have a lot of people that really buy all this stuff, like High Def Ninja, which is like a huge thing for Steelbooks. I mean, they have Steelbook collectors all over the world coming in there.
Those German Steelbooks for a while were like hot shit on eBay. We're like, they were going for top dollar.
Yeah, and look, they're expensive, and they're a real pain in the ass to get done because – unlike plastic cases, which, you know, a semi-truck picks up the pallet from UPS and with a forklift and puts it in the truck and drives it across the country, you know, the forklift accidentally misses the bottom of the pallet and skewers about 100 of your steel books. You know, it's like, you know, and you can't get those replaced really. But, you know, it's, we just decided to try it. And with all the cool varnishes and stuff, you know, that they have and the inside, you can print stuff under the packaging. And we did it with Demons and Demons 2, and it was a success for us. You know, I mean, it's funny how the fans think, oh, they didn't sell them all in 5 minutes. It was a giant fail. Mm. Well, you know, we don't make dollar one profit after we sold the 3,000th unit. You know, I mean, they don't understand business. But after we did the steelbook, then, you know, we did the Phenomena and the Tenebrae. And, you know, we're thinking about doing it for Suspiria as well.
That'd be amazing. Yeah. Let me ask you a question, because I purchased my Tenebrae on High Def Ninja because a buddy of mine did the artwork for one of the slipcases.
Sure, sure.
So in that case, does it you sell to them and then they provide?
Yeah.
Okay, because I wanted to make sure. I felt really bad not buying from Synapse for once.
They do deals with us for X amount of pieces that they're doing their own thing for.
And so, just to explain to the listeners.
If you buy from High Def Ninja, you're still supporting
Synapse. That's great. That's great. Yeah, High Def Ninja does these really great slipcases, and they did, I think, 4 for Tenebrae. They did a batch for Phenomena. It's just like different artists doing different interpretations of their art. It's great stuff. Wow.
Yeah.
You get a cool little coin with it.
I haven't seen this stuff.
They actually hit us up via email the other day. They're like, so
what's next?
Can we do something for Suspiria? I was like, we'll talk when I get back.
And that's the other thing. I mean, obviously, you've already explained very thoroughly how much time and effort you put into it. But one of the things I like about Synapse is there's no like release date. It's like you work on it until it's ready to come out, pretty much.
Yeah. It's like what Valve, the video game company. Mm-hmm. It's like it's done when it's done. That's kind of like our motto too. And it's all my fault.
They have angry fans as well.
Yeah. Jerry gets really mad at me. It's like, when is Suspiria going to be done? Oh, maybe 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. You know, and I say it kind of jokingly, you know, and then he's like, no, really. And I'm like, no, I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. It is going to be 2017.
Right.
Because of all the problems. He's the business end of Synapse. So he's on the phones, you know, talking to the licensors and doing the contracts and doing this. And I'm the guy who's out doing all the, you know, the stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's just pretty much me. And, you know, we have supplement producers like Mike Felsher and Daniel Griffith that help us out and do things for us. But for the most part, it's up to me, and I have to juggle and schedule all these things all at once. And, you know, I mean, I'm still working on Massacre at Central High, you know, and we announced a Massacre at Central High God knows how long ago.
Mm. That was from cult movies. I remember Danny Perry's cult movie.
Well, it's a fantastic film, and Rene Dalder, who is the coolest guy in the world, he, you know, and this is another pitfall. Why is this taking so long? You know, I had another person ask me, you shouldn't, you know, why is Massacre at Central High not announced yet? Did you tell us you were doing it 2 years ago and it's still not out? Rene kind of vanished on us. You know, he wanted to do extras. He's like, I want to do some extras. And we're like, sure, man, whatever. You know, it's your movie. You want to do? He's like, yeah, I want to interview some people and tell them what we're doing. And, you know, I want to put some things together. But I'm working on a movie, so could you wait until I'm done? And I'm like, sure, I'll wait till you're done. And it's like 4 months later, are you done? No, I'm not done. You know, give me some time. And then I give him another 3 or 4 months, and I'm emailing him. I'm like, hey, what's happening? And then nothing. Huh. And then I go, Rene, are you there? We want to get this going. I get nothing back from him. No response. And he's not angry or anything. He was awesome. He's an awesome dude. And I'm like, what's up, man? Where are you? We got to get this thing going. I'm going to introduce you to my supplement guy, Mike Felsher. Maybe he can start putting some supplements together if you're too busy. And then he never responded to that or to Mike. And I'm like, okay. So another guy who does the projection booth.
Mike White.
Uh-huh. He calls me and he's like, dude, I interviewed all these people, you know, and I've got all this great stuff. If you want this for, you know, extras, you know, you can have the commentary. And then the Ging, calls me and says, hey, a couple of years ago, I interviewed Renee. So, you know, we can use that if for some reason nothing happens. And then, you know, Robert Carradine's going through a lot of really horrible personal shit right now with his accident that he had and everything. You know, he got in that car accident. And so instead of waiting for all these people to kind of meld together and do this, you know, we're just going to have to deal with the hell we got. Go, you know, the master looks great. I mean, Renee supervised it and everything, and it was done, and we were working on the audio. And then he just kind of like, he's not answering emails anymore.
I know we're getting close to wrapping, but I'm curious what the bestseller is, because I know Suspiria will end up surpassing it. But what is currently your number one seller?
Well, believe it or not, our biggest seller of all time, I think, was Vampiros Lesbos.
Interesting.
That kind of makes sense, though, because it does. It came out, the art horror and the exploitation.
It came out at the time when Best Buy was still carrying our, you know, all the independent label stuff. Now they don't, and it has that title, Vampiros Lesbos, and it's on the shelves of Best Buy, and it was like, wow.
Bunch of teen boys were just watching Miranda Soledad walk around, meaning like aimless for hours, just to get to one scene. And
it not was just great. Boys, and then married guys,
you know,
with
and
kids.
Then
say, and women,
and woman, exactly.
No, she's hot as shit.
And but, Thriller was another one that was huge. I mean, you know, back in the day, we had the DVD, the red cover DVD, the yellow one was the one that Best Buy took, and it had the porn taken out of it. But the red one, we had limited edition of, you wouldn't do this today, 25,000 units of a DVD, limited edition. And you know, we pretty much got rid of all of them.
I got one.
Wow.
What's, so my follow-up to that is which is a film deserving of selling more but has underperformed? Because that's the movie we will be trying
to push.
We will push
it.
Like I tried to push Slumber Party Massacre 2, and I'm still
in
trouble.
Slumber Party 2 and 3 have come out because of it.
What
needs pushing?
Curtains. That's a good question. No, Curtains is actually selling.
Yeah,
you know what?
Canada, that'd be
you big. Know what's weird? Curtains sold really well, but Prom Night didn't.
Really? And Prom Night is like, it's unbelievable how good that movie looks compared to the millions of versions I've seen over the years.
Curtains was like number 14 on Amazon when it came out. It was like this huge thing, and Prom Night's like, meh.
I think because Curtains wasn't available anywhere
else. Yeah, Curtains was very hard to find.
Like, it was a very hard movie to see.
Well, and the funny thing is like Walmart, you know, Canada, they call us, they're like, you know, Prom Night's a Canadian production.
Yeah, as well, yeah.
So they're like, you know, it's huge here. We want to buy, you know, all these pieces and put it in Walmart. And we're like, cool. And then like 4 months later, they all came right back, you know. Man. And it's like, come
on. And do you
eat
the cost of that?
Of course.
All of it? Yeah,
because Walmart is one of those companies is like it's 100% stock rotation. You don't sell it, and we take it off the shelves, and you give us all that money right back.
Wow. I think it would have been a different story if you had put Prom Night 2 on there, too. That's such a good movie.
Oh, it's a great movie.
I really love Prom Night 2, genuinely.
It's a great movie. But yeah, that Prom Night's probably the one that was like really disappointing. It's like, Jesus, you know?
All right, we want
Jamie
to see
Lee
a spike
Curtis.
In this Prom
spike
Night.
Prom
Night,
come on.
Let's do it for Jamie Lee.
And the thing is I kind of secretly put the audio on the Prom Night DVD or Blu-ray as like 96 kilohertz, 24-bit, just to see if anybody would notice. It's like high res audio, and no one.
Wow.
I mean, we got a few people that were like, "Wow, it's like 96, 24 kilohertz audio," and because all the
now you know
because all the disco music and everything, I was like, "This is cool. Let's do this," and nobody cared. You know, I cared. Nobody else.
If anyone's gonna care, it'll be some of our listeners.
Yeah, right. 90 kilohertz. I'm there.
You
know, the one thing I miss about the DVD trend, and I'm curious if you guys do this at all, is because there used to be sites devoted to Easter eggs. Mm-hmm. Like there'd be a hidden thing where you light a thing on a special. You know, do you guys ever do Easter eggs on your blues?
I think there's one on one of the Coffin Joes.
I'm about to
dive
into that.
All right, and I'm saying that with a half smile because I know we planned on it. And honestly, when I was doing the QC, I forgot to look for it. So
it may be on there.
It may be there.
And it's unquality and controlled.
And it's disgusting.
So it could be crazy.
It's disgusting.
And at this point, Suspiria probably this year would be the hope. That's the goal. The 2017. 40th,
2 years anniversary.
I'm not going to put any pressure.
Right now, for everybody listening, right now, we are done with all the color until Tivoli gives us his final note. So we've been working for 2 months with Tivoli. He's been going back and forth. You know, like I said, bring this down, bring this up, take out the magenta out of Udo Kier. He looks like a clown, you know. and that's the funny thing is with Udo's scene, it's outside.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's sunshine, then it's cloudy. Yeah. Then there's sunshine, and then it's cloudy. And it's like, well, timing this is very difficult because it's cloudy and then sunny and then cloudy and then sunny and trying to get everything. But so we're going through that. We're about 95% done with the four-channel audio. We're right now we're trying to adjust the levels of some of the stuff. You know, the mags came to us without really any mix levels. So it's like, you know, how do we raise this, you know, voice this high? Do we, you know, that kind of thing. So we're going through it and getting it together, and we're working on some extras. And I don't know if we're going to get some of the things that we had planned, but according to one of my supplementary producers, we actually may have something from Refn and Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
Well, yeah, so, it's been such an influential movie.
Yeah, and Fox yesterday, 20th Century, well, is it 21st Century Fox, I guess? They sent me a vault list of some of the things that they have.
Cool.
And they're like, if you want to use this for extras, here, we'll just send this shit to you at your place. And, you know, if there's TV spots or trailers or whatever, go ahead and use them.
You also have an amazing interview from this female journalist named Rebecca McKendry. She's really spot on with her Suspiria knowledge. I think Daniel set that up.
Okay.
Oh, Daniel Griffith. That's
I did the interview with him.
He didn't tell me about
you
that.
You get to hear my musings on Suspiria.
I'm excited about the sound because I saw Suspiria maybe last year at the Cine Family, 35 millimeter print on the big screen. It's the only time I've seen it that way. And it was a midnight screening, and it was just – it was almost disorienting.
Yeah.
Like, it was so loud. I've never heard it that way.
It is. It's
the, and it felt kind of nightmarish.
And you know what? It's probably not the 4-channel that you heard because there's not a lot of projectors out there that can play the mag at the same time. It was a sound system that was designed kind of like – you know, they used them a lot for CinemaScope films because they were so big. And, I mean, Suspiria is crazy. Like, you'll see two women talking. Like, one will be on the left and one will be on the right. And they're, like, way over to the left and way over to the right. And then, you know, like, a sound effect will happen. It'll go and it'll wrap around your head as the there'll be, like, chanting or music that will actually go from the front to the back.
Yeah,
and that's the way they mixed it. For all the audio nerds out there, or the people that don't know, you get, you know, dialogue, music, and effects are all separated so that you can, you know, mix and do dubs or whatever. With Suspiria, it was dialogue, like reel one, dialogue, music, and effects were split. Dialogue left, right, center, surround. Music, left, right, center, surround.
Oh, God.
You know, and so we had 12 tracks of audio for every reel because the audio was moving around in, you know, discreetly. And so,
but
that
why
was
can't
a
we just have it now? I
that
want it now. I want my disc now.
I know.
What's
right?
the problem? Well, I mean, I hope that opens it up for people.
I hope
yet
so.
Again.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. I mean, it sounds insane, and that, you know, it's really like, you know, there have been U.S. home video releases that actually have missing sound effects that weren't, you know, that were just flat out missing, and it's like, where'd that go? But you know. It's there now.
Well, it sounds like you've put a lot of money into this one a lot of time. So I hope people support it when it comes out because it sounds
if this doesn't sell, maybe I'll just be a Walmart greeter or something. It sounds a lot less stressful.
Up in Canada, so you could bitch to them about how they buy prom night.
Yeah, right.
Welcome to Walmart. Why didn't you buy prom night?
Yeah, exactly.
So. And besides, Suspiria's later this year, are there any other titles that you recently announced that are in the pike?
Well, we are finishing up Massacre. Mm-hmm. We just it's so great, and I beg people to like look this up on like Google or whatever and Google the trailer. We're doing The Creep Behind the Camera.
Oh yeah.
Which is a fantastic movie about AJ Nelson, the guy who wrote and directed The Creeping Terror.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, Creeping Terror, like Manos, another film that we put out, is widely, you know, Creeping Terror is also considered to be one of the worst possible movies ever. And it's an atrocious pile. And this movie started out as a documentary about the making of The Creeping Terror and A.J. Nelson, where they would interview people that worked on the movie and his ex-wife and all that stuff. But then they realized, wait, let's do like a docudrama about this guy because it's so fascinating, his story. I mean, he was like one of these guys that comes to Hollywood and basically plays everyone in town to get this movie made. And at the end of the day, he ended up dying in an alley.
Wow.
You know, squandering the money.
This is an Elric movie. I saw it on the festival circuit, and this is for you.
Oh, you've seen this movie. Oh, you've seen this. Oh,
yeah. I forgot what fest it was at. Maybe well, Fantastic.
It was at Fantasia. That played, you know, at a lot of places. But, you know, Pete Sherman, who was the guy who directed it, we did way back when Synapse first started, we did this little stop motion animated thing called Star Warped. And he did, you know, him and his brother had done that. So this movie, I mean, it's got the lead actress who plays his wife. She was in like, she's in Preacher and she's really, really amazing in it. And the guy who plays AJ Nelson is like, I couldn't think of a better, this actor, he's like one of these voiceover guys who does like Japanese anime dubs and stuff, but he's fantastic in this movie. And for people that are interested in The Creeping Terror, the DVD, because of space limitations, we're just going to have The Creep Behind the Camera and the extras. On the Blu-ray, we actually licensed The Creeping Terror from Crown International. Yes, they're still in business. Crown International.
Rolling in off that Creeping Terror dough.
Yeah. And they had original vault materials. They had a duplicate negative of Creeping Terror sitting in the vault. And I was like, this is nuts. We have to use this. So we did a 2K scan of the dupe neg of the Creeping Terror, and we're putting it on as an extra.
That's amazing.
So,
and that's this year?
As a matter of fact, I just finished QC on the Blu-ray and the DVD about 3 days ago.
Wow.
And the discs are at the replicator, but we haven't even announced the title yet. But Creep Behind the Camera, Google the trailer. I think it's on the IMDb. This AJ Nelson guy was the biggest scumbag in the world. And his wife, who they interview in the movie, she's like, you know, he's no one's gonna sue because this actually happened, you know, and he's dead. So, I mean, this guy was a child pornographer.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
This guy, and I even asked Pete, the director, I was like, did this really happen? And he said, yeah. He would pose nude in front of a full mirror with, like, Nazi hats on and the mustaches and, like, look at himself. And it's just like, and that's the guy who made The Creeping Terror. And he's actually the cop in The Creeping Terror. So if you watch The Creeping Terror somewhere – and it's funny too because they it's, you know, even though it's a very serious movie, I mean, this guy was an abusive asshole. The movie has some pretty funny moments in it.
Well, sometimes, I just watched the Roger Stone documentary that just hit Netflix, and it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen, but it's also the darkest and thing telling you about the political system. So I can see how you can kind of juggle that tone.
Yeah, you know, I mean, like even, you know, the producer of The Creeping Terror was alive when they made the movie, and then he passed away like a year or two or so ago. But it's just, the stories are insane. This guy comes to Hollywood just to try to get girls and drugs, you know, and he scams everyone along the way and he gets these people to give him money to make this movie that at the end of the day, The Creeping Terror was never finished. The audio was never found. The guy bolted out of his house after, you know, it was being foreclosed on and they were stealing everything. And the producer went over to see him and he's like, what's going on? And they're taking all this shit. The negative for The Creeping Terror was sitting in a box in the garage. And that's why if you've ever seen The Creeping Terror, it's all post-dubbed because they didn't have any audio really. So they had to recreate the movie by redubbing the whole thing.
Well, I love that we started today's show with you telling a story about the, you know, Blackenstein driving chills in an alley. And then now we've got another.
That sounds like that kind of release. Yeah.
Yes. Right, right. That's Creep exciting. Behind the Camera
hell of
is,
a town.
Is one of, you know, and it's a small film. And a lot of our fans that like the classics like Suspiria or whatever, they're going to be like, eh. No, check it out because Creep Behind the Camera is really, really crazy.
Yeah, no, you hit the right audience.
Send us a preview copy and we will talk about it here.
I may have it in my bag. I can leave it here. I may have one.
Because I'd love to see it and talk about it.
Yeah, cool. It's a great movie and we're going to be putting that out in a few months.
And me and Robert are going to follow you home to the Burbank studio so we can watch a little frame of Suspiria.
If you want to come by, you can come by.
We will report back on that.
Yeah, we will do that.
I mean, I got American Cinematographer coming over tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
Hey.
That makes total sense. That should be on the cover.
But I'll be working there probably Friday if you guys want to pop by.
Let's work it out.
And Jerry, you should – or Don, sorry, you should join us. I've been working with both of them for so long. Yeah. I'm sorry. No, Jerry always yelled at me on the phone because that's what Jerry does. But you should come by Dead Right Horror Trivia Night tomorrow night because I think you donated some prizing.
Tomorrow night I'm working on
Suspiria. Okay,
he's
fine.
Got better
you
things
got
to
big
do.
Big things finish going on. It's all good.
Well, you know, we're working with Fox, and they just sent me this. It's like, we want this and this and this and this. I was like, so I've got a lot of work
you're
to do.
You're reprieved.
I have not
your DVDs
had a day
will be
off
there in spirit.
Since I've been here. I flew in like last Thursday, and I've been working ever since I got off the plane.
Well, we thank you for taking the time, not just to do the show, but the time on the films, and especially Suspiria, because I do think it's one of the most like visually important movies ever made in any genre. And I think people will finally get to see it the way it's meant to. I hope.
Can't wait.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
It's going to be great. If you guys come by, you're going to be like, mouths are
not if. We're swinging by.
They'll be there.
I'll swing by at lunch or something.
Right. Absolutely.
Don, thank you so much for coming
on.
Thank you, Don, so much.
I'd love to come back sometime.
Next time you're in town.
You let us know when you're in LA.
We haven't even talked Intruder, so next time.
Oh, yeah. Well, next we'll bring Scott in, too.
Yes,
that's a good show. That's a good show.
I want a Suspiria episode, guys.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, there are, I mean, Udo's probably in town. Barbara's in town. Jessica's in town.
Guys, we need Udo on the show.
I want a full episode with Udo.
I'm not sitting next to him.
I'll take a
new
massage.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
Thanks.